I'd like to just remind all participants today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin, okay?
Thank you. I do want to just do a roll call for purposes of the transcript, and then we will turn it over to Steve. You have the agenda in front of you. We're going to push as hard as we can to get back on track with the agenda because we do have quite a bit to cover. Let me start with the roll call and ask whoever is on the phone to please state your name.
Mike Rodenbaugh.
Barry Cobb.
Jim Baskin.
Palage.
Michael Palage joins.
Advance it.
Michael
I don't have
Palage.
A cursor for advancing.
Yes, no, Michael Palage.
Did you give it to Doug?
I'm here.
Moderator.
Thank you. Scott McCormick? Okay. Anyone else on the phone who hasn't announced themselves?
Person.
Can I do the room, please, very quickly for the transcript? Phil, do you want to start?
Philip Corwin.
Mikey O'Connor.
Rob Hogarth, ICANN staff.
Anders Halvorstam, WCHSA.
John Nevitt.
Lee Williams with the Financial Services Roundtable.
Ron Andrew.
Scott McCormick.
Chris Chaplow.
Steve DelBianco.
Sorry.
Don Berard.
Steve DelBianco.
Marilyn Cave.
Fred Gallman.
Jeff
Chris Martin.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay. We now have the recording is going on, and we have the record of who's in the meeting, and we're going to move to the agenda item. Let me turn it over to our Vice Chair of Policy Coordination, Mr. DelBianco.
Thanks, Marilyn. I've got about 10 slides to lead through this, and our agenda calls us to wrap this up by 3:30. I don't think there should be any problem with that, depending on how fast the discussion goes. So I started off, and those of you who are on the phone, you can both look at the Adobe Connect room or the PDF I distributed by email a little bit ago. And those of you seated at the far end of the table, if you need to move down, please do. I started off by reminding us what our mission statement is from our charter. And the mission for the BC is to ensure that ICANN policy positions are consistent with the development of an Internet that promotes end-user confidence, competitive in supply, registrar, registry, and related services, and is technically stable and secure. And it's always good to remember that's what we're all about, and let's take a look at how we're doing on that this year. Mike, if you go to the next slide, I still have a cursor.
Okay. But only if you're really nice to me.
Oh, yeah. I'm not here to make Mikey cranky the way the board was. Makey Mikey cranky was the purpose of that mission. Thank you. So how did we do in 2010? I think that we can be proud of the fact that BC is always present, even if our views don't always prevail. I understand that. But we serve, our members and counselors serve on 12 different ICANN working groups, chairing two of them. And Mikey here in the room chairs at least the big one at VI right now, two. And the BC was the largest constituency at the Nairobi meeting. We showed no fear and went to East Africa, and it helped to make a huge difference because we were able to move so much of our points to front and center on the agenda. We have been really active hosting outreach and board perceptions at every ICANN meeting. They're not just social, they're intended for membership, as well as building relationships with board and staff. And as you know, several of the BC members, several in this room, are actually very active at the Internet Governance Forum, into all of them, and are always there to articulate the business positions. It's practically the same positions we articulate at ICANN. We simply carry them into the United Nations environment as well. Next slide, Mikey, because how are we doing on posting positions? Because our charter, 6.3, says wherever possible, the constituency will produce written positions on relevant issues. Not all issues, but relevant issues. And so far this year, since this executive committee was formed, we've posted 8 formal positions. And if I run down these real quick, I mean, we talked about the VI working group initial report, and there John, Sarah, Ron worked it to pull that together.
Steve, you're breaking up a bit.
Okay. The PEDNR working group report, Gary Bob worked on that. The GTLD draft applicant guidance, we got comments in there, thanks to work from Ron, John, and Sarah. Barry Bob did the registry benchmarking study. And we did a draft report on who is accuracy. Susan Kawaguchi did that for us. Philip worked on the new GTLD expression of interest proposal. We did comments on the initial report on RAP, registration of use policies. Again, that was Barry. and several folks worked on the process for amending GTLD registry agreements back in March. So not too bad, we've got 8 comments in, but I'm convinced that it should and could have been easier than it was to get these comments drafted, reviewed, and approved. Second, I'm convinced we could do better. We could do more, and we could do better on this. So, Mike, go to the next slide. I think that we have a challenge. And with the Bee City, our main challenge is to get broader participation by creating and updating these Bee City positions. And the key word there is updating, not just creating. And also, we need more time. We need sufficient time not only to review the drafts, but if folks on the Bee City have comments on it, there has to be time for those comments to get worked back in to our draft position so that the revision can get back up and reviewed in time. And our charter calls for a 14-day review. So however many iterations we did with your comments, we still need 14 days to get the thing approved. That's a huge challenge for us. And let me try to propose a couple of solutions. And again, we can stop any time for questions rather than deferring them to the end, including those of you on the phone. If you have questions, just interrupt. Mikey, next slide. I'm talking here about a proposed solution that was discussed on the last BC member conference call. The charter itself permits us to appoint an issue manager, we call it a rapporteur, and create an internal working group. And what I've emphasized here is we need to create them in anticipation of ICANN comment periods, council votes, and ICANN. You can't just create them the day that ICANN posts a report for public comment, because even if it takes just 2 or 3 weeks to organize who's the rapporteur and to get started, we've eaten up half the time. The ICANN comment periods are 4, and at the best case, 6 weeks. So it's just not working. The process that we have in our charter isn't working with the way this is done. So ideally, if we were able to, we'd circulate a draft position at least 4 weeks before comment. I'll give you an example here. If we started now to develop a BC position on brands, strings, and GTLDs, we'd try to get it done before staff issues the next applicant guide, in anticipation of being able for them to comment on the guidebook in the little window we'll probably get for it. And again, I want to say that's not easy at all to comment on a report that's going to come out with just 4 or 6 weeks. In theory, we burn the first 2 of the 4, trying to get somebody spun up, trying to extract a volunteer from among you who's not already swamped with other things and get it done. Now, what happens when you're just compressing the timeline and there's nothing more we can do about it? There's situations like that. They may require that we try to come up with a fast track or a condensed review period. We sometimes do it. We may have to explicitly do it. And I believe that might call for a charter revision. And then Chris Chaplow will lead us through a discussion of potential charter discussions later on. But let me not turn to that. On a solution that doesn't require a charter change. Mikey, slide 6, please. I refer you to the charter, section 6.2. This is our current charter. It says from time to time, the executive committee can set up committees or task forces to initiate a position on a relevant issue. And we really haven't done that, at least not since this executive committee's form. And we'd like to propose a few of them today. And what I'd like to put on the table for discussion are some processes how these internal working groups would conduct themselves. And this is not a charter item. The charter itself doesn't specify every jot and tittle on how groups have to work. So we believe that the BC can suggest and simply follow certain procedures for these working groups without embarking on a charter change. I put here 5 principles, I think, that I would recommend for these internal working groups. Any of you can join. The EC would appoint a working group chair, and they obviously know the issue, but really put the time in, but ideally we would avoid someone who has a significant interest in the outcome going one way or the other. Now, and I realize why, Chris, as opposed to
without an interest. Right, so you can have an interest.
Well, I definitely say so. You're right. We may not be able to find somebody who has no interest at all. And in that case, we're going to have to go first.
So for purposes of the transcript, the person who asked the question was John Gerard.
Yes, it was.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Marilyn. The,
you're breaking up pretty badly.
All right. Is that any better?
I think you have to turn it on.
Is that any better?
Is that any better?
Thank you. And this notion of trying to find a chair who lacks a significant interest is really with respect to these internal working groups. I want to be clear. If several of you feel passionately about vertical integration, you can and should join the ICANN GNSO working groups, and you may carry with you your significant personal interest when you go into an ICANN working group. That's understood. But in that capacity, you're not necessarily representing or chairing the business constituency's position. This, on the other hand, because we're going to propose creating a vertical integration and brand TLD internal working group, for that group, this is we'd love the chair to be agnostic about how it turns out, which is the same thing I'd say of Mikey with respect to the GNSO working group and beyond. We should follow, I believe, the GNSO working group guidelines. A lot of us, Mikey included, worked on these guidelines. Jay Scott put a lot of time into it. We ought to follow those. We don't have to create our own guidelines, procedures. Let's follow the working group guidelines that the GNSO has already put into place and adopted. I think that the working groups that we form internally ought to propose their own charter. I don't even mean that they have to have a charter, but think of a one-sentence objective as to what it is they're working on and by when they would hope to produce an outcome. And finally, I think that we really want to insist that the working group host its discussions on a website, a social text, Ning, Drupal, a social discussion board that's available to all BC members, instead of emailing to each other multiple versions of documents and discussion threads that quickly escalate to insane. What did you say, Mikey? 4,500 emails on the VI working groups? And it's almost impossible for somebody to enter that discussion 2 days or 2 weeks after it's begun. You cannot hope to catch up. On the other hand, if we were able to host our discussions with these internal working groups on a site like Social Text or Ning, there's an opportunity for members to join, to quickly see all of the document versions that have been produced, and to follow discussion threads there, I hope, that will prove to be better than email. A couple of our members had contacted me as policy coordination chair to say, please create separate lists in the BC because I don't want to be on all the emails. It's too many. Well, this solves that problem. If you wanted to deep dive into the vertical integration or even just observe, you simply become a member of this particular website, this social text website. Now, I think that, Chris, later on today, were you intending to give us your feelings about some potential tools we could use for that?
The Ning site, yeah.
Great. It's a site several of us have used. And I think that if we talk about that, we'll realize that it isn't going to be a technical leap to get there. But there are some organizational leaps that we'll need to get there. And that is mostly about recruiting people to join. Yeah, please go ahead, Mikey.
Well, I guess I got to get closer to a mic. I'd be cautious about
Mikey O'Connor.
Thank you, Marilyn. I'd be a little cautious about following all of the GNSO working group guidance because things like public comment periods, et cetera, get pretty elaborate. So you may want to back off on that one just a touch.
Mike, this is Steve Del Bianco. Mikey brings up the point that there may be some very onerous requirements on a GNSO working group that we would not want to adopt. So let me agree completely on principle that we would only adopt those that serve our member interests and the transparency within our membership, and that we don't want to hold an obligation to elements of that working group guideline that would make this more work than it's worth for us. And might ask your help with that if we were to quickly look at the guidelines. If you were able to refer me to certain chapters we would not want to follow at all, that would be really helpful. And I think that Mike Palage has a question, and then we have to take a cue in here.
I don't think Mike's on the call.
Okay.
Mike, are you on? You're not on the call, right? Let me take that down.
He didn't.
So great. Thank you. Marilyn?
So first of all, I made a firm commitment to all of our members that we will make decisions in today's meeting that take comments and make proposals as much as possible. So with that spirit, we have to make some decisions, but with that spirit, I think that there's a number of things here that we would want to think about, the last one being the one that you mentioned. I don't actually think internal working groups should follow the GNSO working group guidelines. I think they should be really customized to support the purpose we charter them for. And along that line, I would say that I think our charter says task forces, but, you know, we could call it whatever we call it. But I think we also want to think about what mechanisms we use to scope out policy positions, maybe proactively, versus the mechanism we use to develop a policy position, which might be joint rapporteurs or a trio of rapporteurs. But I, the other thing I would just say is I'd be very cautious about ending up with the same thing that I think the ICANN GNSO VI group ended up with, which was a bunch of people in a big pile trying to sort through too much stuff at one time and spending a huge amount of time on process and not being able to piece part into, decisions. So I'm just saying, as we think about the use of task force working group, maybe we should think about, do we use them to scope issues? Do we use them to follow issues? Do we use them or a variety of mechanisms to develop positions?
Marilyn, Steve, as the proposer of it, I would have said the objective really is to develop, that scoping and following would come with it. But as the proposer of it, I thought it's about developing, because we're suggesting it in response to the fact that we don't have a broad participation doing things soon enough in advance that people can get their approvals in. And I think of the last several positions we filed, it felt rushed, and I don't really feel as if it was broadly participatory. I don't know if any of us were pleased with the way the clarification went through on our vertical integration points. We could have done better than that. So I did mean it for develop, to answer your question, but I'm happy. I think it's the right debate to have. And we have Chris and Mikey.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I guess my question would come to the actual development of the position, and one of the important things is when you do, let's say these working groups are to develop a position, I think it's really important that any suggested positioning they do or come out with is then ensure that it circulates a full BC membership for discussion and consideration there. You know, especially if you're moving to a model where things aren't circulated on the email list for the full membership and as a general practice around working groups. It's critical that all BC members have an opportunity, even if they aren't tracking something specifically on a consistent basis, that when it comes down to an actual definitive position, they have an opportunity to weigh in.
Chris, this is Steve. It's as a proposer of it, it was my sort of assumption that once a internal working group came up with its discussion draft, that we pick up in the charter on item 7, and the discussion draft has to make its way through the BC, full membership, via email, the same way we've been doing it in the past. So that picks up with the 14-day notice deadline on item 7.1 in the charter. So this is all happening within the charter about setting up a task force or a committee, but the process of review and approval does have to be done according to our charter. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mikey.
This is Mikey. I just want to respond to one thing that Marilyn said. I think one of the huge...
No, it really wasn't, but it looked that way.
Hello.
Exactly, but it was FDUK, but I was like...
So someone is speaking on the BC call. Is it your intention to participate in the call?
That's
bizarre.
Apparently not.
What was that comment?
We're hearing a woman's voice participating in the call, and we were asking if that was someone trying to participate in the call.
Time. Okay.
So it's not a woman's voice, and I am participating in the call.
I don't think it was you. Keep going.
Go ahead,
one of the things we really want to avoid is putting a group of people together with very divergent views that don't have time to negotiate with each other. That's the problem that DI ran into. Basically took wildly divergent views, put them in a pot, and said it has to be done in 3 weeks. So I think that the danger of the VI model is something that we can engineer out at this point. if you took this model that you've got here, Steve, and you put it under the same kinds of constraints that BI is under, you'd get the same result. You'd get a log jam. But I think that there are ways, I have a list that I've been developing, to step around that. And so I think this is a fine approach all the way from monitoring to developing policy. But we do have to be careful not to put people on a sort of a no-win.
Mm-hmm. You know, ironically, the way in which we've done the eight positions that are posted this year. The way in which we've done the eight positions that have been posted this year is we had a committee called the BC membership, and it included people with divergent views, many of whom had limited time to negotiate a consensus outcome. And that is why I'm proposing we can do better, because the whole of the BC has not been particularly effective. It ends up being one or two people who will put the time in. I think of how John, Sarah, and Ron tried to pull together a consensus document to clarify our position on VI. We end up self-selecting two or three people that are willing to do the work, often at the last minute, and that compresses the time for the rest of the members to evaluate a draft and make meaningful comments that will then get reflected in the next draft. So the dilemma you pointed out is the status quo. We have that now. And this effort of creating subcommittees, working groups, is meant to see if we can attract people that are willing and able and care a lot about it, appoint a chair early who has the least amount of significant self-interest, and you'll see in the slides that follow, try to attach some deadlines as to what kind of a position comes out. Because there are deadlines about public comment periods, discussions we know are going to happen at a meeting, and Zaid and Mike will talk to us about votes the council will have to take. So, I mean, I am anxious to learn everything we can from you who've chaired two very difficult working groups. And if you can import the lightest weight structure onto what we do with our internal working groups, we'd be very grateful for that, as well as insights as to how to avoid the log jams that you're talking about. Anyone else have an observation or question? I'll take from this that there's no way that we should embrace the third bullet I threw into this proposal. There's no way I want to dictate that we follow all GNSO working group guidelines, but rather some lightweight subset of that. Marilyn?
I think this needs a little more thought from folks to think again about now. I'm saying working groups or task forces may be to scope issues as opposed to develop positions. They could go either way according to the charter. But I am going to ask people to quickly think about this and get back to Steve. The last time we used a working group model, I chaired a who is working group at the BC years and years ago. And following that, we did also do a trilogy of rapporteurs on who is, which seemed to work very well as well. So think about past models we've used, not just the working group model, because in some cases a topic might lend itself to co-rapporteurs versus a working group, while in other cases the diversity indicates that a working group or task force or whatever we call it ends up being the right model.
John?
John Berard. Marilyn, I don't want to overstate the value of a consistent vocabulary.
Sorry.
But I do think that based upon comments I've heard, especially from new members, that it's bad enough that we have an acronym for something.
Yeah.
The fact that we can talk about it in three or four different ways only adds to the level of confusion. And so it just speaks to what I think is that is a granular aspect of what I think is the most is an issue that I am fixed on with regard to the business constituency, and that is its ability to influence ICANN decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
My experience with ICANN begins in 2003, and I have learned over those 7 years that the only two real ways to influence ICANN decision-making is to sue them or to show them how they can make potloads a month. And so, as the business constituency is trying to chart this you know, quoting Bill Clinton, I guess, we're going to that today, a third way.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that the third way begins with us doing two things. One is broadening and deepening our membership, which means we have to become increasingly relevant to business everywhere, not just the United States, but as you understand because of the reception that you created in Brussels, but also to begin by having our own consensus that we can then reach out across ICANN constituencies and build collaborate. And so I think that what Steve is proposing is an extraordinarily important first step, tactile step in getting us to a point where we can broaden and deepen our membership, where we can find out if there is indeed a third way, or if we just, you know, go to the mattresses and just have a bunch of lawyers on staff and sue ICANN every time we wanted to do something.
So let me be blunt. I agree with you completely. The reason I made the distinction about it might be a lesser item that's not leadership-oriented that would take a quick rapporteur approach as opposed to a leadership approach, which is what I think we're all in agreement on. So I would say SSR is an example of a leadership opportunity. That would be my premise. While responding to maybe the issuance of the toolkit when it happens is a short rapporteur issue because it's not strategic and leadership. Does that?
Again, it's John Berard for the sake of tape. But unless we can become more relevant, as your first slide said,
right.
we
present
and always
heard,
it's going to be hard for us to grow into the kind of constituency that we have the ability to. And I thought Steve's point earlier was extraordinary, that the least capable committee of ICANN is the board. It's a remarkable admission.
It was Christina's point, right? And Steve confirmed it. What I would add, John, one moment, is you said there were two things, broader or deeper BC membership.
Right.
It's an effort to achieve the objective of being able to have more influence.
And to collaborate or to build the consensus
across lines. And that was the second thing. And that second one actually requires that we have something in writing sooner than we do now. See, 2 weeks before something's done, we may feel like the BC has hit a home run. We've got a draft position ready 2 weeks before it's due, pursuant to our charter, and we lob it over the wall to the ISPs or to Deborah Hughes at the non-commercial side. That's too late for them to digest it and come back with something. So there becomes a real premium on doing advanced work, and I took that, just been in this position now for only 8 or 9 months, but I take that as our hugest challenge. We have a lot of capable people who will get involved, but getting them involved early enough when there isn't even a document to respond to is the only way we're going to win this deadline problem.
So you have two.
Who else in queue? Bill? Lee?
Phil Corwin, just commenting on John's comments. I wouldn't disagree that suing or providing a profit motive are the most effective ways of incentivizing. I think I have seen, particularly in the new GTLD context, a third way, which is to be, and sometimes a preparatory to threatening number one, which is suing, which is to be a very squeaky wheel, to protesting loudly, strongly, and often creating controversy, creating threat of derailment of what they're up to, but just filing the comments and expecting them to have any real effect. I think we all know that it's necessary, but it's necessary to be on the record, but it's totally insufficient in terms of really having any significant influence on policy decisions.
I would say to John Bergen, I just wouldn't want to give up yet on the notion that if our membership list were the right sort, that it would be able, that it would help us wield a little bit more influence. And you're right. I think the squeaky wheel is essentially the precursor to a lawsuit.
I can remember that in Nairobi, the significant presence we had there, where one of the key decisions was whether to proceed with the expression of interest, the EOI, and Chris is nodding because our presence was not shrill. It was as as intellectually honest as we could be about it, but we think that our presence and persistence on that issue affected the board's vote on the EOI. And it was not out of trying to be beating the drum over and over again, but being where you needed to be at the right time with a definitive statement. And both sides, Phil, used the extreme tactics, right, the advocates and opponents. And then we have Lee.
I haven't been around long enough to know whether we need these groups or not, whether there's a real need. But I have a couple of quick thoughts that arise from my experience in trying to get volunteers to lend their expertise to get all the way to some consensus view. Just a couple things to think about as we refine this idea if we decide to move forward with it. One is, I'd argue for a minimum number of these task forces. I don't think we have the bandwidth to manage a dozen. We might have the bandwidth to manage two or three. I think the ones that we should gravitate toward if we do it are the ones that, by virtue of their long-term nature, are chances for us to lead. So they're probably not creating a comment on one thing that's been released, but there are things that we know will be standing issues for a long time. We have a chance to enlist some real expertise for people to get to know one another. And then, as needs to comment or to weigh in or behind the scenes to give some input arise, that group will be ready. I tend to think that we should gravitate toward the most tangible product. So if we have chances to think in terms of monitor or scope or develop, I kind of like develop. So first, these people ought to get to know one another and form some common views on the policy. But then they should be commenting in a very detailed way on exactly what we all can weigh in on. And I think that is more their task than to be sort of in the shadows every once in a while generating something that gets released to the broader community. I would try to make it as clear and tangible and specific a product as possible.
Lee, go ahead. Sorry. Four.
Last one, purely administrative. I'm not very optimistic about our finding chairs who have no conflict. So instead, I think what I'd say is we ask people to avoid conflict where necessary, to mitigate or manage it as much as possible, and their ability to rope in other people actually, at the end of the day, will help to manage that because there will be other experts working with them, looking over their shoulders. That's probably, at the end of the day, as much as we can really hope for.
Stephen, way down here.
Yeah, let me just quickly see if I had one of Lee's points down. You said focus number two was to focus on long-term issues where you would have a chance to lead. And I guess in 10 years working with ICANN, every issue becomes a long-term issue, even if it was invented to be a quick hit. But I take your point is that we wouldn't want to dilute our efforts too broadly. But you talked about two or three at the same time. We often have two or three positions under development or two or three work groups on which
I think is survivable. Five or ten probably is not.
But again, I have to ask a clarifying question. Leading is different than finding certain topics that our members do want us to provide a statement on, but what we are going to be is responsive. And so I would say as chair we have to be able to do both, mm-hmm. but that we can't do more than two or three strategic type leadership issues. That would be what I would take out of this. Is that
helpful? I think we could have ad hoc participation in things that come and go, and we should, because at the moment they may be important, but there might be some things that we know are just permanent issues that will always be with us that are worth spinning up a group and having that group always ready to weigh in when the latest permutation mm-hmm. of that issue arises.
We have that with Who Is today. There's four or five of us that do that, but it isn't official. I mean, it's not an official group that's been convened with anything, but it ends up being the people that you go to ask, what about this study? Do we vote for it or not? And we participate. And we had, I think, Ron and then Mikey, right?
Thank you, Steve. I just wanted to comment on what the comment Lee made, and I thought just to put a footnote to the idea of whether or not a chair has a conflict or not. Part of the Operations Steering Committee's new procedures and how the GNSO will operate, which basically filters down to all working groups and all elements of the GNSO, is the new SOI and DOI. issues. So an SOI, that is your statement of interest, is a public document that if you're on any working group, it's posted, and it really says who you are, where you're coming from, so people can measure your words accordingly. A DOI, there was a little bit of confusion in terms of how that got translated, and so there's clarification that has to happen. But a DOI happens in the case of a meeting starts now, here's the agenda items, and the chair will say, of all these items, does anyone have a declaration of interest they need to make? Meaning that I may have taken a client yesterday that has something to do with let's say, policy priorities of the BC. So, therefore, I would then step up and say, yes, I would like to make note that Mark Monitor is my new client, and therefore I have a declaration of interest in here. So I'm just trying to give the BC membership recognition that there are things that will help to allow for a chair to be able to park his or her interests and be able to chair. And also, I think there's some guidelines on how chairmen and women will actually run meetings and so forth coming down in the toolkit. So there's a number of things that will support what you said, and I agree with that. Thank you.
Ron, would you recommend, being someone who's been part of that, would you recommend us asking for SOI or DOI from the folks that chair our internal working groups? Because currently the candidates for executive committee, we all had to file an SOI as well as our counselors. But I don't know that. Well, outside of that, the rest of you who participated in the GNSO working group have filed an SOI.
I think one of the things that anybody who listens to me on all these calls, I always talk about institution building. We are building an institution here, and it's an 11-year-old child today, and it's going to be 12 next year, and it's going to be a while until it's 22 and can actually, you know, pay the rent on itself and do its own laundry. So we need to make sure that every decision we take is institution building. And I think along those lines, I wouldn't see any reason why we wouldn't have in any of our internal working groups, people just file that documentation. It's an online form. It's a pretty simple thing to do. But that way, at least keeps, you know, we're in keeping with the standards of ICANN as an organization on a macro level and a micro level.
So in order to move this on, I'm going to ask Rob and Ken to take that suggestion as a potential insert into the BC Charter for discussion, because it would be an operational rule, and we can maybe deal with it there, Steve.
Okay. Let me ask, though, since it just came up, what do the members on the phone and here think of the notion of requiring an SOI to be involved in any of our internal work group teams? And I know, Fred, you've just moved to a microphone. That's an ominous sign, but do you have a...
No, I agree. It's a great idea. But that wasn't what I moved to the microphone.
Is there anyone who... objects to it?
I think it's not only a good idea, I think it has to be required of officers and counselors, and it is required of counselors to file at the council level, but I think it ought to be required of all of the officers as well.
I believe it is now. We all did SOIs to run for election. But, Mikey, with respect to the working group guidelines that you worked on, do those working group guidelines at the GNSO level require SOI DOI?
I need to correct a misperception. I worked on that working group for one day, and I've never been taken off the list, so I'm actually totally clueless.
Okay. We'll have to study that up later. Anybody feel strongly against doing statement of interest, declaration of interest? Oh, that's great. Fred?
So quickly, I apologize in advance for two things. For one, I'm going to have to leave early, and then for second, for reading ahead your presentation. So, you know, before I go, it's a great idea, and you know, the idea of actually, as we suggest, working on things that provide tangible benefit and making specific recommendations. I like the idea that, I am interested in one of the things that you proposed on a subsequent slide. I'm willing to help.
Well, if it's okay with everyone, we've probably beaten it to death with respect to an abstract process proposal. For Fred's point, let's move ahead to the next three slides, which are examples of three internal working groups that have been suggested over the past 3 or 4 weeks, and I imagine that Fred's main interest is the first working group.
Yes, and like, my point is I'm just willing to participate either as a leader or as a, you know, as working within a subgroup within it. So that's just it. A branded TLD is something I'm interested in, and I do have a certain amount of conflict, but I think I'm able to manage it.
Do you have to leave immediately, or do you have another 5 minutes?
I have 5 minutes.
Okay. Like, I'm going to put three of them up there. Let's go to the first one, please, which is the idea of a proposed... Go one more slide ahead.
Oh, okay. One more.
Thank you. These are the three we wanted to cover. The first one being on new GTLDs. And Marilyn made, I thought, a great suggestion to cut that into three topics: brand, restrictions on VI, and the notion of guidebook and overarching issues. Because as if new GTLDs weren't complex enough, it really does have three different parts. And if you were to participate, and I've already recorded there were some members, John on the phone call volunteered to get involved in that, so did Adam Palmer. I assume that Mikey and the rest of you, John, who've been involved on the VI working group, Ron, would all want to be on here as well. I just assume that, but it'd be completely up to you if you wanted to. I know you're carrying quite a bit of load. Mikey?
I'm getting confused.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go back
look at
to John's point, which is why on earth would anybody want to join the DC? And I'll tell you why I wanted to join the DC when I joined, which was at that time, DC was the gateway into ICANN policymaking for me. So I paid the money to come to the DC and meet all of you and hang out and stuff. That reason's gone. I don't have to pay money to be a part of ICANN policymaking process anymore because I can participate in a working group as an individual. I don't have to be part of the DC or any of the other constituents. So this is tying back to John's point, which I think is right on the money, which is why are we here? And you know, if I'm participating in a vertical integration working group, I am, and I'm spending a fair amount of time on it, and there are other VC people that are in there, do I really need a formal, do I need another series of meetings to go to get on my calendar, to have Adobe Connect remote call?
I think that's a great question. Keep in mind that it's about outcomes. Tangible outcomes are positions that get approved, voted on, and submitted and formally posted. And true, individuals can submit comments too, but presumably a constituency like the BC, if it approves a formal position, is a different kettle of fish than having an individual file a comment. So that's one reason to stay in the BC, and I hope that you plan to.
Well,
and then you ask about double the work. So
yeah.
Let me be clear. I would invite all the VI working group members, but not expect, since you're already doing the hard work in there, but not, I mean, there is no formal designation. None of the BC members who are in the VI working group at GNSO were sent there to officially represent the business constituency position. You all joined because you cared a lot about it. It was your gateway into policy. And presumably you're free to represent your own business and personal interests while you're on that working group. You saw what happened, though. We needed to file formal BC comments on the report that came out of the VI working group. And that was different. That caused us to go back in time and look at what the BC had said about vertical integration last fall and to evaluate whether that would need to be updated, either because opinions have changed or plans have changed. So they're different. Participating in a GNSO working group is different than an internal working group whose goal is to produce an outcome like a position.
Hey, could I make try this slightly differently, Mikey? So on brands as strength, I think there's a significant leadership opportunity and challenge for the business constituency. So let me take that as a working group which needs, and that's strategic. On BI restrictions, I think the business constituency, as opposed to multiple individual members, needs to examine updating a position, and maybe that's a rapporteur initiative that's tactical more than strategic. So I'm just trying this, and I think maybe the guidebook and overarching issues
reaction
is also reactionary. So just we're doing this in real time because we're trying to understand where the members are, but brands as strengths, it seems to me, from my conversations with brand holders and with governments, and the risk that exists if I can actually try to transfer a brand being used as a string away from big corporates to ICANN's continued existence, deriving the need for, I'm going to call it special halo treatment for that category of users, not just U.S.-based, but I think that's a strategic question. The other two things, Steve, maybe our members would feel like, okay, we've got six people working in a VI group, in an ICANN-wide VI group, but there is a point at which, now, let's go to the second question.
there are times when we are going to be too divided to issue a position, and the only thing we can do is fully inform our members so that they individually file their comments.
Not just that, but if the chair of the VI working group, the big GNSO working group, turned to his members around the table and said, well, what does the beastie think in the context of having a discussion? I wonder what kind of an answer you get today from your BC colleagues, because none of them can say, well, I know exactly what the BC's position was and speak for it, unless they're referring to something we've adopted in writing before.
Or the answer could be the business constituency has decided not to develop a specific statement on topic X because many of our members prefer to file their own statement. So I don't know that we specifically mentioned that, Steve, but that is one of our options, right?
Well, let me jump back in. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about VI is that the official, quote, official, unquote, statement from the BC is pretty just. It's like a year.
November, and we updated it. We cleaned a lot of the dust off last month, Mike. You know that.
But
which is a clarification. Thanks, Fred.
There wasn't.
In the car.
There was consensus there. You know, and so I. Where I'm going with that,
we approved it. We approved the position.
Where I'm going with that is once upon a time there was unanimity, or at least close to it, and statement was written, and later positions have evolved to where there is not unanimity. How do we get rid of the whole?
Amen. All the more reason to do something like this, where a position gets looked at with the specific intent of updating it.
Or
Barry Cobb, for instance, is,
or cancel.
Well, I'll say what updating it could be canceling,
okay.
Withdrawing. Restating it. It could be any of the above. But isn't that, I mean, this is not just forming position, but updating. And that was on slide 3 where we talked about the need to update a position. Is Barry on the phone, too?
Yeah, he was. Hi, Steve. Yeah, I'm here.
All right. And Barry, I know this is something you called me about a week or two ago, the importance of having a formal way to update a position where it's going to take some time to work through that update. It's not something you can do in the context of a 4-week deadline on a public comment period.
I agree. I agree. Everything that you've been stating, Steve, I fully support because even if we as the members on the VI working group that came back and then I decided to volunteer to help put together a new position statement to or a revised position statement to start that process for the BC to update it, just even sending out the position statement to the BC members isn't enough. There's some way, some mechanism that we need to try to inform the members and try to help them bring them up to speed as for those that are participating on that particular working group. And then in addition, once we provided the information and then provided one or two or three statements, you know, we need to definitely make sure we figure out how we can vote on it and move forward. And certainly the lead time we have today is definitely not enough.
Thank you. And then Ron, Andrew?
You know, maybe we can put another slant on this. Maybe we might want to consider as a constituency that the people that are sitting on these working groups are there representing the constituency. You know, the IT constituency, when they participate, they don't participate as individuals, as I understand it. For the most part, they participate as members of the constituency first. So therefore, if, as an example, Ron Andruff is a member of the VI, working along with Barry and others, John, if I'm there as a in principle as a BC representative, or I could say, you know what, Steve, Marilyn, I really feel strongly about this personally, so I'm going to step outside of the BC camp on this one, and I'm going to go fight my battles in the VI working group on my own position, not a BC position. What we might be doing is killing two birds with one stone, meaning that we would actually have a small subgroup going and fighting for the interest of the organization, of the constituency itself. And ultimately, democracy will rule. You know, if there's six of us and four are saying it this way and two are saying it that way, well, the two of us that are on the negative side of that are going to lose, and the policy decision that's going to be handed up to the larger constituency might go that way. So I'm just throwing a ball out there suggesting that maybe that's one way of handling it, maybe it's not, but it certainly seems to me that there will always be small interests, small business interests within this constituency that won't necessarily jive with large business interests. So,
Ron, we didn't formally
break right at the beginning there.
Got it. We didn't formally restrict.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, what those of you who decided to participate in the VI working group did, and if we had, if the BC had tried to say that, yes, John Nevitt, you're the BC's rapporteur, or Mikey or Ron was the BC's rapporteur, well, then you would have been significantly restricted to only represent one position from November of 2009 that called for, at the time, the status quo of a 15% ownership restriction with an addendum wanting to get flexibility for Dot Brand. And that would have only got you so far. If you see what I'm saying? You would have felt very constrained, and I doubt we'd have had any volunteers who stuck around for long if you had to be constrained. What we are left with is if the playing field has changed, if there are new facts and circumstances, and the board and staff are taking us in a different direction, we need to actually have a more fluid position on VI, one that gets vetted inside the BC and quickly resolves in something we can vote on and that you can carry, if you want to carry it as a banner to the VI working group. But, I mean, the example you brought up is a good one. It would have been, actually wouldn't have been good for any of you if we had tried to constrain each of you to the November 2009 position. Could you have really done your work on that?
Yeah, no, that's the point. I mean, then I would have had the option to say, you know what, I don't agree with the BC position, so I'm stepping outside and going and appearing in this group as an individual. Because within the group, if you look at the listing of every discussion we had, you'll see the various constituency members, the various staff members, and the various people who participate as individuals. So in many cases, I was carrying the BC torch in the discussion at VI because I felt that. You know, I fell on that side of the platform, so it was an easy one for me in that regard. But I don't know, just an idea throw it out there that maybe we might want to look at that.
Honest, Chris.
Yes, just a point. We can talk about the advantages and the disadvantages of people, members being on working groups, either representing themselves as individuals or representing the constituency. And the only point I'd just like to make is there isn't at the moment a clarity of whether people, which camp those people are in. That's the thing we need to look at going forward.
Thank you, Chris. And when I've been on working groups, when there's an opportunity to have a discussion, if I'm always careful to try to say, well, the position of the VC, which we adopted in November 2009, is X, and I don't agree with it anymore, or its position is this, and I'm going to set that aside and give my personal opinion. And I'm conscious that I've heard from time to time Ron do that. And, John, you're relatively new to the BC, and I don't know how conscious you were of what the position had been. And Mikey, as chair, probably don't do any of that. So we all end up with three people who are very different in the way they would disclose their interest or disclose who they're representing, because each of you had a different understanding of what that position was.
So, Steve, here's what I'm going to ask as chair for you please to think about in this fact. We need to get a proposal before the members, whatever it is, of how to deal with such circumstances, and whether that means that we first of all have some kind of an informal discussion among interested, besides the working group thing, because right now, our members don't have a mechanism that authorizes them to speak on behalf of the BC unless they are the rapporteur and there is a existing position. Now, if we're saying we want to change that, I think we also have to take into account what Chris suggested, and that is, members may not feel comfortable that based on time and availability, it's only those who have an immediate interest can spend time on something. I don't know the answer. I just think the fact that I can move to this interesting open approach in working groups leaves us with a question. So can we maybe take further discussion on how to deal with this, ask you and others?
I will take that on to get it started, but it is different than the notion of an internal working group. Clearly made that,
yes.
Right? That we're speaking now, we're kind of jumping between two worlds, the ICANN working group world and the internal VC working group, where there's a different, slightly different, more focused objective.
And can I ask you to, can I ask you to think deliberately about whether, and I don't mean to prejudge the answer, I don't have an opinion on the answer, on whether the existence of a working group outside the VC would lead us toward or away from creating our own internal working group. You could argue that if there's already a VI group, we don't need one. Or you could argue that if there's a VI group, we especially need one. But make that call.
I think that's a great question. And when you observe the three examples we're going through, this being one of them, it seems these three examples led to the latter conclusion, that the existence of a working group that had a position to spit out of it upon which we had to comment forces us to have a position.
So I just need to ask a point of clarification again, and it's to precision here. A working group versus developing a position, because a working group assumes there are different ways of developing a position, and right now we sometimes do it, Lee, with one or two rapporteurs, and it circulates, and we don't actually have an ongoing membership.
Right.
The rapporteur takes comments and puts forward a position, and it gets voted. I'm just trying to say, a working group is different from what we have generally been doing.
That's right. And we had Jeff and John. Go ahead.
I guess the general comment on these issues is, you know, for example, of brains and strings, I didn't get a sense from the meeting today about how or whether that's going to really be dealt with in the process. So maybe there's a step before we get to the, what would the answer be. There's almost a higher level issue of,
if we had any
issues aren't even on the agenda right now.
Well, can I ask you to speak to that? Look at the bullets under timing. What I attempted to do here was to suggest where there would be opportunities to use the output of an internal working group on these topics. After Kurt said,
valuable input into the process may just be, here are scenarios, as this we were talking about this morning, we may not have the answers on how to, write the rules. We may never come to agreement on all details, but we would certainly agree that there are scenarios that don't seem to fit under the current.
Mm-hmm. And if we did come up, and if we came up with those scenarios and wrote them, if we submit them as a BC official position, we need 14 days to look at them. Sometime before Cartagena, applicant guidebook version 5 is going to be published, and there'll be a 4 to 6 week period to comment. And so I wrote those down as potential drivers for the timing of this. Ideally, we have a position on the guidebook, and that this group would be charged with drafting. Not approving, but drafting our position on applicant guidebook V5 for a 14-day approval of the membership. So I feel like this one does have, this sort of thought of being hanged in the morning hanging over their head, that there is something coming up. I don't think, the first one I put up there was providing input to staff as they're finishing up applicant guidebook V5. But from what Kurt Fritz said today, I don't think they're going to listen to anything we would send over the transom until it's been published.
Hi, this is Bill Smith. I joined about 15 minutes ago. If I heard this last stuff correctly, with the applicant, the DAG, that'll be published and for a 4 to 6 week review that we would then assign to a potentially to a working group, internal BC working group, which would then have to issue a draft report some 14 days before, so 2 weeks, so they have 2 to 3 weeks to work on it, and then
that's
we get
right.
comments back, and I just don't see how that, personally, I don't see how that's going to work time-wise.
And therein lies the need for the plan that's been laid on the table, Bill, because we would want to form that working group before the ICANN applicant guidebook V5 hits the website. We'd want to form it, ideally, we'd form it in the next week or two, so that it's begun its work earlier by looking at the last set of comments we filed on draft applicant guidebook V4, take a look at the board resolutions that fed into it, and begin to draft the position in anticipation. That's the only way we're going to solve the timing dilemma that I talked about on the earlier slide. It's hard enough without an internal working group. The idea of an internal working group is to make it possible to get broader, deeper participation with an adequate time. But if people feel it's more work than it's worth, we probably won't go down this path.
Well,
it's meant to solve the very problem you brought up.
Is another possibility is to have that group, have it to be more an ad hoc group where interested parties can participate to help establish their own company's position and to attempt to come out, basically report from a number of companies in essence the same position. Because here it would be difficult for me to pass around a document and to people I would need to get approval on it, make comments, come back, do the redraft, et cetera, and to develop our own comments if we choose to submit.
No, that's an excellent point. And I do hope every company follows an admonition Marilyn gives at every meeting, is to please submit your own comments, share them with the rest of the BC members. That goes without saying. This is an opportunity in addition to actually have a formal BC position when it's really relevant to us.
Steve, let me ask Bill a follow-up question. The IPC and the ININTA, I think, have these committees, and the committees hold a call with the document in front of them. I sort of know a little bit about this, but at a very high level. They hold a call of interested parties with the document in front of them. They work through the document, share information, and then in many cases, companies or associations do what Bill just suggested, is they then take that shared learning and go back and write their own positions, but the purpose, the sharing purpose is very valuable. Sometimes they could hold, maybe a group could hold two or three review calls,
mm-hmm.
but not try to fight through to a firm position, because we're going to have a lot of, we're going to have a big spread in the members, I think. So maybe that's another functional mechanism. I did talk to a company last week who is not presently a member, who is interested in becoming a member, and her specific question was, well, do you have these briefing and discussion opportunities? Because that's what I'd like to do. So just a point of information.
Okay. And let me ask you, does the IPC also, when it can, adopt constituency positions formally?
Well, I think we see that they do, but
right.
You often see that a lot of the work is done by a subgroup of members
right.
and then leveraged.
And do they have a formal approval with a timeline? Yeah.
It's shorter, I think.
14 days, John, do you know?
Okay. No, I think it's shorter.
14 hours. John.
And this is Barry, but in reference to the IPC, don't they meet more often as a constituency? Like, I guess in my perfect world, I would love to have the BC meet on a monthly basis, and then whatever is the most pressing policy topic for that time frame, whoever is the rapporteur or whoever volunteers that maybe participates on a working group that would be able to present a little bit more in-depth of that particular topic, and that would help set us up incrementally as we get closer to when public comment periods open, and then at which point time, you know, we can try to move to a vote on that particular topic, et cetera.
Thanks, Barry. John Brar?
It's now moved.
Any other comments on this this particular example of a team?
So this is Susan. Can I get in queue?
Please, go ahead.
I participated on several INTA or on a couple of INTA committees and then the sub-working groups, and to me it works really well. And it is a fast timeline, but for the most part I would have been reviewing the document or the DAG, whatever is at issue anyway for our company. It's much easier because of the difficult approval process here. Facebook doesn't like to make statements necessarily on their behalf, but it's easier to help form the opinion in other groups. And so, and you know, I've done that with BC comments also. So I really think if we implemented a small, quick working group for some of these issues, it would be really helpful.
Thanks, Susan. Mike, you advanced the next slide, or did you have a comment on this one?
I have a comment on this one, but I can pull to the next one.
The next slide, the next two, talk about two other potential internal working group topics, and they're very different than the VI GTLD one we've been discussing so far. The first is near and dear to Jeff Brueggemann, right, as the security, stability, and resiliency appointee to the affirmation of commitments review team. And on this particular one, I've only recorded two names that I know were interested, several names, I think, at the bottom that are interested so far. But it occurs to me that the timing of this one is everything, because there is a lot of SSR input and reaction that we already know is going to come up in the next 12 months. It's pretty much locked into place, Jeff, with the AOC's review team, for one. And we know that there are public comment deadlines, three of them facing us right now on SSR. On November the 3rd, that fiscal year 11 update to the SSR plan, the one I referenced this morning in the first session, those comments are due November 28th of October. I'm sorry, due the 21st of October, and they've got to be done by the 21st of October here in BC to give us our 14 days. And that plan itself lays out what it is ICANN proposes to do in the next year on SSR, and it's really short on concrete measures they'll take to increase compliance, for instance, which is one of our pet concerns. There's two other SSR timing elements that are going to face us. Another is the public comments that are due on November the 5th on delegation rate scenarios. And that report says 300 to 400 a year they could handle in delegation. Kurt Fritz said this morning 215 or so. So that is due the 5th. We'd have to have comments circulated to the BC by the 23rd of October. And then finally, there's another comment report also due on November the 5th on root zone scaling and new GTLDs. And that's an ESSAC report that basically says they could handle 1,000. But it has a whole host of assumptions in it. It says, assuming that other aspects of all DNS root management are not altered, quote, it seems probable that normal operational upgrade cycles and resource allocations will be sufficient to ensure the scaling of the root, both in terms of new technologies and new content, and that they will have no significant impact on the stability of the root system. So if we, the BC, or individuals, if we don't actually comment by November the 5th on that report, and no one else has yet, then the board and staff have only one report to rely on, and that report says that they can handle the root stability. And if we feel otherwise or we have other questions and concerns, it's vital to start studying that issue with an eye towards getting a BC position submitted by November the 5th. So here's where timing drives the need for the group. And with respect, I'll let you talk to the timing with respect to the affirmation of commitments team. What do you think the timing will be on input that you gather and reports that you issue?
You know, we're having the first call on Monday, so I have no information at this point about kind of the schedule or what. But I do agree completely, even when we had the internal discussions with the GNSO as they were vetting candidates, one thing became clear is you get into a discussion about what issues should be included in the review on security stability.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a desire by numerous participants that we need to include the end user issues, and it overlaps a little bit with the who is. But I think that's something where the BEC can help set the agenda, both in that context and more broadly, that then can translate down to next year's budget and the plan. I feel like there's a big picture message that we should be carrying on behalf of our customers, as well as then taking it into the week.
Can I have a follow-up? So, with regard to root zone scale, okay, the business constituency, the position could be we don't want to see that affected. We don't want it degraded. It's root zone scaling, it's really important that it be impeccable and remain impeccable. And that would be our position. The board then says, that's our intention. Our intention
right.
is that it remain impeccable.
And here's a report that says we can handle it.
And here's a report that says we can handle it, so we're good
Done.
To go.
So that wouldn't
let,
be much
and then,
value.
And then let, but in fact, is that not an appropriate business constituency position? Now, on the other hand, we have businesses in the business constituency that might have a raised eyebrow
mm-hmm.
over ICANN cavalierly saying that they can handle 1,000 new domains. Mm-hmm. And how do we accommodate those two things, right? So you can raise it to a level of consensus where, hey, if you say it's going to happen the way we want it to happen, then we're good to go. But beware, if it doesn't, there will be heads will roll. Now, whether heads will roll or not, I have no idea. But then how do we incorporate the comments that the insightful stuff from AT&T and from Verizon and Google and others
that actually are managing DNS, that are managing, VeriSign were here, John, they might have some point that they could add about the root zone server system, correct? I mean, how do we do that?
John, it's Marilyn. Let me try to add to that, okay? I actually spent a lot of time with folks who did the root scaling study about this very issue and went to the microphone in both Seoul and Sydney on this point. Root scaling and how many new strings you can put into the root are not the only issues and implications of SSR. So I think we could coherently say at a very high level, it is not just the question of how many new TLDs you can put into the root, but as your own study says, and it does say this, that the kinds of strings that go into the root and the downstream implications also have to be taken into effect. Therefore, we as business users and companies who are building and operating vast parts of the Internet do not agree that this can be taken in isolation, but must be thought about more broadly. The answer that you get is, I know from talking to them, is no, we're stopping at what we're responsible for. So maybe we can, I just have one other thing to say. Jeff Bergman is the CSG representative to the SSR review team, and Susan Kawaguchi is the CSG representative to the WHOIS review team, and Bill is the independent expert. Maybe we could put on a next meeting, getting an update from all of them about what the review teams will be doing, because I think it's fair to your point that you're just going to be began.
Mm-hmm. And yet, but Jeff, if it's anything like the Affirmation of Commitments, Accountability, and Review team that Becky was on, one of the first things they did was to ask for community input. And the minute you know that that's going to happen, that ends up being the key timing item that'll drive. That's worth one down. And John's emphasis on root scaling was partly in response because I've identified two of the deadlines in front of us as a constituency are to comment on the root itself. We may decide not to say anything on the root and treat the broader issues of SSR that Marilyn just articulated. I understand that. But it is appropriate to say, do we have something special to say about the root? If so, a week from this Thursday, we need to have a draft circulated to our members if we're going to do something as a constituency. Mikey?
I think we're trying to solve the wrong problem. The problem we're trying to solve is to come up with a process to write BC comments, when in fact it seems to me that what we ought to be working on is more grassroots organizing almost, where what we have is a legion of fabulous leaders that are participating in working groups, which is where the choices actually get made. I mean, for those of you who've been on working groups, you know that these comments come over the transom, and then we're between initial and final report. We practically land at the plane. Right at the very end, we get these comments that people labor over. They don't influence the final report very much. Wait a minute, don't interrupt me. The problem is that what we need is effective, informed, diverse, articulate people in the working groups. I think that we're trying to arrive at a unified decision or a unified position from a diverse group of people. My views on these issues are going to be different than AT&T's, because AT&T, I'm a unit of one. AT&T's bigger. It's okay to have different points of view. What's important is that we know each other's issues, we know each other's talking points, we're on the ground in the working groups writing the reports before they get to initial report, rather than writing these comments that are in a way left over from the old era when it was not bottom-up consensus, it was representational voting from constituencies. But that day has passed. We're in a working group model now. And I think that
the trouble with this approach is that it doesn't give the on-the-ground people the resources they really need to do what they need to do in the working group. And I'll go back to VI, since I've lived that one. It would have been, I think, quite helpful if the members of the BC who are in the VI working group had had a way to educate the rest of us about those issues and do some of the negotiating that we found so hard to do in a 75-person working group amongst, I'm going to leave myself out of this, yourselves, so that then you guys could have gone in arm in arm and said, you know, this isn't an official DC position, but we've been thinking about it, and here's a way out of this logjam that we're in.
Got
that
it.
Could make the BC incredibly influential, but without all this superstructure, mm-hmm. This seems like too much superstructure.
Mike, let me respond in two ways. You're definitely right, we need good people in the DNSO, but that won't be sufficient to fulfill the charter. One of the first slides I put up is item 6.3. It says, in the charter that I was signed up to work, it says, wherever possible, the constituency will produce written positions on relevant issues. So in addition to throwing really good people into your working groups, I actually won't be doing my job if I don't work towards a constituency position. Second thing, the audience for the constituency position isn't necessarily your working group. You see, it's often staff and the board who's receiving a report that comes from you about which we may say we agree with parts but not all, or we disagree completely. So the audience isn't always your working group. Sometimes it is the board and staff.
Acronyms.
It might be, and in which case our charter's an anachronism. And I'm glad to see that you volunteered for the Charter Revision Committee, because currently we as a constituency are supposed to do positions. And until we change the charter, that's really what we're here to talk about, mechanisms of doing it more effectively. Let's all head to the bar, right? Marilyn informs me we have only 8 minutes, which probably now is only six. So the last slide, which is looking to the same thing we talked about with Jeff and on the SSR. We talk about who is proxy and privacy services. Look at the timing on this one. We have a proxy report. Comments are due the 28th of October, which means we need to have them together by 15th of October. That's later this week. This is a report done by a University of Chicago Consumer Research Group, and it concludes by studying the top five GTLDs that 18% of the domains in those GTLDs use either a privacy or proxy service, and nearly all of that is proxy. 91% of the 18% was proxy. It says nothing about who and why they were using proxy and privacy services, and it may well be that the BC doesn't need to comment on this particular number, as to say whether we think it's high, we think it's low, we don't like the methodology, or we may comment on the implications it may have. But in the next 3 days, we need to have somebody who had spun up on it and had something they thought the BC would want to submit as a position. It turns out we have many more bites at the apple if we don't, because almost all of the work that's done in the Who Is studies that we've been working on, the four of the first five Who Is studies really drill into what's going on in the proxy and privacy side. Who's using it? Are they revealing and relaying in accordance with the rules that they're supposed to follow? So council is already contracting with study groups to do those studies, and when those studies come back in, the BC will have opportunities to comment on the findings or even inform staff on how to frame the studies themselves. But on Who Is, we also have input coming up to the Affirmation of Commitments Review Team on Who Is. And Susan Kawaguchi, you're on the line with us, I think. Has your group met yet to talk about the timeline, whether you would solicit public input early on in your process?
No, we have our first conference call the 22nd. And I don't even think a time on the 22nd has been agreed upon yet. So.
No, we're still trying to figure out when we would have it, as best I can tell.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't.
And only you and I and one other person, Wilfred Weber, have indicated that we're reasonably available.
Exactly. So it did make me think that we are going to have some issues with the group.
Yeah, we have one individual who has said over a two-day period they're available 1 hour.
Yeah.
So that's what our group's doing.
Yeah, so it's become the when is group, like when is everyone available?
Yeah, exactly. So
All right. So I don't know that we can say that you're going to have a requirement for public input before Cartagena. And you can't even say it's whether you anticipate presentations or meetings in Cartagena.
Steve, I would have raised...
At this point, I know nothing, so...
Great.
Yeah.
Marilyn?
I want to raise a point that I had a chance to mention to Susan, but I want to mention it to Jeff and Bill and Susan and all of you in public, and I asked Becky to join us to possibly make a comment on this particular point as well. And it has to do with the previous review team insisted and had to fight to be able to get a budget to have independent and external support to support the work that they need to do. The existing two review teams, decision seems to have been made for whatever reason, instead of assuming there's going to be a budget available to provide that kind of support, to rely on everybody being a volunteer. Recently, as a matter of fact, there was even a call for a volunteer auditor rather than a paid auditor in another function. My view as a business constituency is that we ought to think about having a strongly held position that adequate staff support and resources are made available to all of the review teams without exception for them to be able to do their job, not to overburden the people that we had sent onto those teams with administrative functions. Because they are reviewing past work. They're not planning the future, but what they do affects the future. And I thought maybe, Becky, you might just say a couple of words about the need to be able to make sure that, those resources are available.
I've been listening to the Accountability and Transparency Review Team conversation for the last couple of days. I am pretty sure that one of the core recommendations that is going to come out of that is that there needs to be more support for policy development and working groups and all of that stuff at all levels across the board, that the sort of, you know, be skimpy with the professional expertise support in the development of policy and in the working groups is coming back to cost us a lot more in the end. On the who is, I think it's particularly important to have people with expertise in various privacy regimes available as a resource. And I don't know who volunteered to be the privacy expert, but in the last round of who is, it was very clear that there were a lot of people spending a lot of time articulating the it's the law in pick any country when there was no basis for the positions they were taking, and I know that happened in the GAC over and over again. So there's just a you know, there's a lot of asserting that the law doesn't allow you to do one thing or the other, or requires you to do one thing or the other, when I think it's really based on there's not a solid expertise supporting it.
And as you know, that was one of the studies we requested be done about who is to make a determination of what the law is. It hasn't been contracted yet, but that is one of them that's in the queue. Jeff, you have...
I thought the other rationale in the accountability team was to get an external view. Look at the inside processing of community input, but you also want to think about how IT
I think in the transparency review, Berkman has provided a pushback on things. They are it's really in addition to the case study, there's real contributions to the discussion about what the recommendations are and refinement on the recommendations that come out of that. I agree that's definitely true on the stability.
All right, we'll wrap up this policy session. The last slide, which is the one I have up here, talked about the next four public comment periods that are coming due that I felt were particularly relevant to us. We've actually discussed all four of these, and based on the discussion I've heard so far, I think the one that deserves our attention is the second bullet. And Jeff and Bill, with respect to security, stability, and resiliency, it would be evaluating that fiscal year 11 update from staff, determining whether you think the BC should take a position there. We'd have a week and a half, come up with a draft. It's work you guys are going to do anyway. Since you're on the SSR, it's work you're going to do anyway. Why not get a head start? And love to work with you with it.
Bill, hold on just one quick minute. So Jeff's on the SSR. Bill is on who is as the expert, right?
But Bill indicated to me he wanted to work on
sure.
the internal group that would do SSR.
Sure. Can I just raise the question, though, if we could go back to the list that was on
the SSR slide.
The SSR slide.
Could you go back?
And see if that list of folks.
Yeah, anybody want to add?
Might volunteer to look at that quickly.
Anybody? Bill, Adam, Scott McCormick, Jeff Brueggemann, and Lee Williams.
And Scott, yeah.
Yes, I think the fiscal 2011 plan is the most important piece on there, and we'd be happy to help work on it.
Can I just add one thing is missing from your list, which is the accountability and transparency review team report?
Ironically, it's the first thing on our list, on our general. Becky, you didn't get a chance to see our full.
I just meant upcoming comments.
Got it.
The bottom, because that's going to come out soon.
That's right. What will be the time turnaround on that as well?
I think they want to get a final report done before Cartagena.
Okay. Thank you. All right, that's all I had for the policy session. A lot of input today. I will try to summarize your corrections to and suggestions to the proposal and get it all back to you.
So actually, I'm going to see if I can summarize, and at least in the room and on the phone, I thought I heard support for I think the word in the, and I apologize about this, I've been calling it working group, the word in, we have to make some updates in the charter, we'll talk about that, but I think there's support for forming some kind of a quick look group at looking at SSR. There's a list of names here. What I would like to propose for general agreement is that group of folks and anybody who thinks they have to be in that group take a quick look at that set of topics and plan to come back, besides looking at what needs comments, plan to come back with a strategic set of recommendations for the BC on what our role as business users is in SSR. So that we can say, this is what our mission says, and this is what we, these are the kinds of things we might do, and then the full membership, Chris, to your point. But we would also be looking at what we need comments on. On the question on the new GTLD process, I actually heard two different things, and that is an interest on the part of members of maybe having a collaborative, hard look at the JAG and sharing experiences and perspectives, and then maybe assuming that we would make, that individuals would file their comments.
Mm-hmm.
On brands and strengths, I think we have enough interest there to at least try to have a call for people who would like to talk about that more, Steve.
You're thinking that's a separate group or a topic within one group?
I think it's a short-term look. If we feel strongly that brands of strengths are not treated properly, there's nobody else in the in ICANN who owns taking a lead on that space.
Or I guess maybe being a separate group.
And on the question of vertical integration, I guess I would ask the people who are individually, think about whether, Steve, the people who are individually working, if we could do a call with them as you have done.
Right, we've done two of those.
And said, okay, what are we going to do on this, if
right.
anything?
But it's asking them the question, should we and how would we update the BC position?
Yes.
It's not the same as Mikey's question to his work group. It's whether we would update a position. And Barry Cobb feels real strongly about that, and I know he volunteered to.
Okay. So then the other thing that I would say is we're going to talk about this during another discussion. It is not clear to me that we are properly organized to support the reorganization that has taken place in ICANN, either at a council level or at a policy level. But maybe we need to shelve that for another discussion time and try to get some work done and that, Steve, and take advice from the ICANN staff on, you know, like working, you know, the restructuring, improvements, et cetera.
you know, it's time to lap those improvements and do another set of GNSO reforms to turn out a little better than the last set. I'll turn it over to Chris Chaplow.
This is Bill Smith. I have a question. With these reforms now at ICANN, at an ICANN level working group, can anyone participate?
So let me try to answer that. That was Bill, right?
That's correct.
Bill, there are certain groups where if we are sending a BC representative, and one of them is a group I'm going to speak to in just a minute, then the executive committee has to appoint that person. So the DNS cert terms of reference saying we were asked to approve a BC representative, and we did receive a volunteer, and we did appoint Scott McCormick to that. Working groups like the VI working group are open to any individual, but they are representing themselves. If the BC sends someone, then the executive committee gets nominations, volunteers, and you know we put you through a long grilling of basically saying, thank you very much, send us your CV, you're on. But we do have to approve, if it's a BC representative, the executive committee does approve that, notify the rest of the members, and send that name forward.
Right, right. Okay, so I get that. Now, how is it that this DNS cert committee, as appears to me, has received, you know, it's a special committee then? If ICANN has gone to this bottom, truly gone to the bottoms-up model, because now this group has limited membership.
That committee, real quickly, is to develop a terms of reference. That's not the actual group. That is a terms of reference group, and it's been continually morphing. Scott, can you spend 2 minutes on an update? Sorry to throw this to you.
Not a problem. So the SSR, or sorry, the what was called the DNS CERT working group, just to clarify, by the way, this is Scott McCormick, just for the record, there was a little bit of confusion. DNS CERT working group got turned into the Joint Stability, Security, and Stability Analysis working group now. That is the official title on the draft charter as of 7 October. There is a tentative schedule for three upcoming calls and then a possible face-to-face in Cartagena. As of right now, that's all we have for updates.
So things continue to evolve. We did get a call for names. At the time, we only had Scott's name as a volunteer. If we have other volunteers, Scott, are we still able to add a second BC representative?
I can double-check that.
Would you check that? Bill, can we get back to you on that?
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand how things work, being a relative newcomer. Because Mikey's comments around the place and time to put resources in a bottoms-up model is basically you do it early and often, right? Because in that model, the work gets done earlier, and at the end, it's too late to be making comments, right? Positions have been established at that point, as opposed to a model where a draft is sent out from above seeking comments, where you then go off, right, develop comments, throw them back, and the cycle, you know, you have a waterfall model. So that's what I'm sort of struggling with here is, are we, you know, as ICANN made the change to be truly bottoms up, or is it in this state of flux? And this appears to be a state of flux.
The answer to that is state of flux. Secondly, this particular group we're talking about was a strange hybrid animal where it's not really clear what the process is for creating groups like that one. And, Rob, are you going to respond to that, and then we're going to go on?
I did. I wanted to note a point of order first, and, Bill, I have to respond to this first. I think the process right now is not a waterfall. It's more of an Escher staircase.
Got it.
Now, secondly, just and my point of order is we've been talking about working group guidelines. Right now, those are just a proposal. They've been developed by a work team. They're being reviewed by a steering committee. They haven't been approved by the GNSO Council yet. So just in terms of this concept of anybody can join, that's not been formalized yet. I know it's happening in a hybrid-type model. The GNSO Council has adopted that in a number of different instances, but I'm just pointing out that there is still a process ongoing that conceivably members of this group, collectively or individually, could comment on.
Bob is, however, of course, referring to the GNSO working group. And the weird group that, the hybrid group that Scott is now on is actually a cross-ACSO group, which where it's even vaguer. But we will check on whether we can add a second BC representative. I think we need to move on. And, Scott, we're going to look to you to maybe give us further. The one other summary note that I would take, Steve, is I think our members have said that they could appreciate thinking about monthly calls if they had a firm agenda and we had informational sessions related to policy. So could we take that up in the executive committee discussion separately?
Right. I heard that from Barry, but I actually didn't hear it from anyone else.
You heard it from Susan? And you heard it from Susan?
Okay.
And in fact, switching from lists of dates and process to actual content would be a delight on those calls. I mean, you know, it's fine to hear all the dates,
right?
What those of us who sit at the bottom-up process really need is knowledge. We don't need to know about the dates.
We did do two of those with respect to VI that John Ron, Bill were on and Mike wrote on. Those were hour-and-a-half conversations about the VI topics. And it was open to BC members, and we probably, if you're going to have a deep dive into the topic, I would at least allow our members to understand the deep dive will be on this topic, SSR, led by Jeff Rubin or Bill Smith, and that would be an option. It wouldn't be something where we conduct VI business on the calls. Those who are on the topic wouldn't have to join.
So could you take that list of topics you have and maybe think about prioritizing, and we'll try to put put something together. Is that okay? Okay, we're going to go to Chris.
Great, microphone turned on. Can everybody hear me? Great, fantastic.
I'm sorry, Chris. Bill.
Okay, I'll be very brief. I just want to note on pending issues for comment. There's one that Steve didn't mention, and it's a 10/28 deadline. I'm not advocating a BC comment. I want to mark the issue, though. There's an application from the Arab Center for Domain Name Dispute Resolution in Amman, Jordan, to become a UDRP provider. The ICA will be objecting to this on the grounds that ICANN should not be accrediting any new UDRP dispute providers until there's a standard contract for providing this. I think we've long said it doesn't make any sense that you have to register or renew a domain with a registrar that's accredited, but these UDRP providers, you can transfer it away or extinguish it. Once they're approved, there's no continuing contractual relationship, and I don't believe this is just an issue for domainers. We are moving from, there's another group in India that's indicated they may apply to be a UDRP provider. You know, we're moving from a world eventually of UDRP provider duopoly of NAP and WIPO and a few GTLDs to a world of hundreds of GTLDs and probably multiple UDRP providers. And a lot of big corporations can have investments in a lot of those new GTLDs. And the only way, and a lot of these providers can be in countries, I'm not saying it's considered, but different legal cultures. And when you have that, the only way to assure uniformity, consistency of result, and predictability that this remains a low-cost avenue, and not something where you have to keep going to courts to try to get a reverse it, is to have a standard contract. So I wanted to just mark the issue as something that I would hope that D.C. would look at in the future. This is separate from the issue of what the rules for UDRP should be, is whether the provider should be under standard contract.
Share with us the comment that you draft. And if the AEC were to adopt a formal position, we would actually have to distribute it to members by Thursday of this week. And that might be a big list. But please let everybody know, so those who agree with your concern can echo it. There are only two comments posted on there right now.
It's already on there.
Okay. It's on number four.
Okay.
The BC calendar.
Oh, there it is. Got it.
Now to Chris.
Okay. Thank you, Marilyn. If you want to move the slide on Chris Chaplow, Vice Chair, Operations and Finance. Just jumping to something which actually wasn't on the official agenda, but I thought it was worth bringing up so we can actually see where we are in terms of membership now that we're happily post our 2010 renewal round. And we're actually, our full count is 48 members. And it's actually interesting to note on my list of people on the, at this meeting, I've got 21 members. So I think that's very good, 21 out of 48. And one or two might have dropped off the call. I've just seen an email from Sarah. She's joined the call. So, and I won't read them out, but we can see the list there of our new members and, unfortunately, also a list of our leaving members. Do anybody want to take any questions on that, or I'll move on?
Let's just keep going.
Keep going, okay.
I did have one question. Hmm. On a recent call, we discussed the need to retain the membership of a large European Small Business Association, which I believe is MEDEF. Is that right?
That's one of our associations. That has small members. We have many associations that have small
European
members, and there's one sitting right there that has, that has a number of European members, too.
I thought I remember the executive committee saying it was really important to try to keep them in, and somebody, I forget who it was going to...
And we did, and it was Philip, and he tried,
and
but was unsuccessful.
Great, thank you.
Through the process. And actually, I think Interborder Holdings were in that process as well. Just a quick analysis of members by category. We've got 31 members in the Category 1, 2 members in Category 2, and 15 members in Category 3. Just give you an appreciation.
And so actually, before you go on, let me go back to that. So this is probably important based on MEDEF is a regional association that has large and small members. They have never been active and had been interested in one particular issue, might become interested in the issue again, and that has to do with the impact on their members of defensive registrations and whether there's a benefit to advancing awareness about the change in new GTLDs within the European region. So they might become interested again. Two other associations we have that have very strong European presence include WISA and ICC. The Philip Shepherd's Association, AIM, does have a significant number of European companies and a lot of North American companies who have European presence. ETNO, who is a member of ours, has 37 companies throughout Europe, and they have a European presence. And I would say they are normally mid to very large size companies, just in terms of the breakdown.
Yes, I think it might be interesting to do an analysis for around the world for our membership, and I can do that for the next meeting. On to the next slide, please, Mikey. Finance Committee, I'd like to formally make the introductions. Welcome to John Nevitt. We're now formally constituted under the current clause, section 4.8 in our charter, which gives us guidance of what we're supposed to do, and that also says we're on with member retention, which just in passing is something I probably will come on to charter later, but it's something probably the worst thing to do, to give a financial accountant the job of convincing members to stay on board. But anyway, and outline there, we've actually kicked off and we've had our first teleconference, and then we've produced an important report for the ExCom and had a quick meeting this morning. So thank you, gentlemen. Next slide, quick financial update. Couldn't be quicker. This is a simple version. The bank balance, the 1st of January, you can see it there, 62, and the bank balance just at the end of last month was 63, and the 2010 fees are now collected, or almost. I'll just show you that again in a moment. And I think we've only got about $500 still outstanding that's still got to be approved for the website. Next slide, please. Thank you. This is an analysis. I hope you can read it. It's a financial update. It's a simplified version of the budget that's been approved, and I had to simplify it to be able to turn it into a slide. And I think next year's budget we can make a bit simpler than this one. We can see the member subscriptions on the top line. We've got two columns, budget 2010 and the actuals for the first three quarters. The member subscriptions predicted were 30,930, less some adjustments of 4,000, and our actuals, we've actually got in the bank at the moment from members 27,000, and there's 3,600, I calculate, which is members that have either just paid or the money's in transit, and I'm confident enough to say call that money as actually collected subscriptions, but it wasn't in the bank at the end of September. 15,000 that we were going to take out of reserves, and excuse me, giving us the total income, as we've seen, income, what was in our budget was slightly conservative, so our income is going to be slightly higher at 46,000. And then we got the list of expenses. Well, we can just read them down there. Has anybody got to ask any questions on any of that?
I just want to make a proposal. Is it appropriate for me to do it now? That on the both on the BC travel and on meeting refreshments, we are going to have some expenses associated with doing an outreach event in Cartagena, and we've been invited by the CCs to consider getting better acquainted with the CCs. Very quickly, I will tell you the chair is changing in the CCs, and will be elected to go to the board in June, so there will be a new CC chair. There's, I think, a really good opportunity and timely for us to increase our relationship with some of the CCs who have a big interest in SSR, as we do, and this may be a good opportunity for us to try to do a breakfast or something. That and the second thing is that I've been reaching out to the three new board members, and I have asked if we could do something just for the BC membership with the three new board members to have a get acquainted discussion. That I think that would be a good move for us before they take their seats. So my point is, I want to spend your money.
Let me throw another name. There's a new ALAC member in Mark Rothenberg.
I know Mark.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good privacy guy. In terms of the privacy discussion, we might want to try to reach out to Mark.
Mark is known to many of us, and we can do something with Mark, but I probably wouldn't put him in with the board.
No, I'm not at the same
surprised
time.
He joined.
Right.
He's appointed to the ALAC. He's one of their
Chris, in looking at this, this would tell me that we've got a little bit of money in the BC travel. We've got we're not spending money on members' calls. We have the $500 for chairs miscellaneous, most of which is going to have to go. I think half is going to have to go to cover the shortage here. Then we've got, so could you put something together so we could just figure out what we reasonably could propose to spend on doing a breakfast or something of that nature
in Cartagena? Yeah.
But I think we can do it without stress on the budget.
Yeah, so things are, you know, relatively comfortable there, and we're coming in actually on our income. We'll be slightly higher, and I think at the end of the year, our costs will be slightly less than the budget. The next slide, please, Mike. Yeah. Administrative support plans. Just to remind everybody where we are or what's happened recently, so many people will know, but I'm just going to whiz through it. Our secretariat resigned at the end of 2009. In February 2010, the website and emailing lists were moved to a company, Showbeck Integration, in Portland. The ICANN are now providing the conference call facilities. In 2010, there was a temporary arrangement for the first couple of months, actually, without a contract or written contract. And then in March, Marilyn signed a temporary contract for a monthly retainer for the banking, looking after the banking facilities, plus an hourly rate for any administrative work. Also taking note that the charter that was proposed and approved in October 2009 defined our secretariat services. We've also been promised this toolkit from ICANN that was sort of promised mid-year, and we're still awaiting details exactly what that will cover or what that won't.
Sir, that includes the phone calls you referenced earlier.
Well, which you get credit.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. And another background information is that the IPC are interested in shared administration support. That's moved a step closer, actually, as the slide said before, but we had a meeting yesterday with Steve Metallitz, and they're now in agreement to move forward on that one. Okay, next slide, please. Focusing in on the banking options, currently the BC funds are in a client account of the company which was the old secretariat. I understand client accounts is like when you can often have lawyers and you send lawyers money and they put it into the client account. So it's not a situation that's very desirable, because there's a lot of question marks, as I see it, as if something happened to the secretariat, then what would happen to the money, and we don't have access to it. And there was a highlight of this one, a period in the summer when we were doing a position statement. We needed to know exactly who'd paid and who hadn't, and we actually weren't able. We did not know for 2 weeks the answer to that question. So the Finance Committee looked at this situation, and we submitted a detailed report to the ExCom on the banking arrangements. There are two options, effectively, for us, two practical options. One is to keep it as it is, and somehow renegotiate a contract with the old secretariat, and not just renegotiate a financially desirable contract, which we certainly have not got at the moment, but to negotiate some sort of contract to make sure we actually own the money that is in the bank account if in the event of something going wrong. The other option is to move the bank account to a treasurer type account here in the USA, in the same way as the IPC of their model, and then contract the administration function separately. The reason why that model was never worked in Europe is because you can't do that in Belgium. You can't do that, I obviously know about Spain, because the BC is not legally constituted. You can't open a bank account in the name of the BC. You can in the UK, and you can here. They seem to be comfortable here and in the USA and the UK with the concept of a club or society which has a treasurer who doesn't own the funds, and the treasurers change on a rotating basis.
For money.
Moving on, really, I'm going to come off the fence now and say clearly my recommendation, having studied it all, is that we need a robust solution for the BC, and that we should move to move the bank account to the States and open up a treasurer-type account in the same way as the IPC have done.
Don't you guys just do that?
I think we can do that. But
otherwise, we're in a position here where we're not allowed to make decisions. So would you guys either do it, or we have to wait until we start?
Well, I'm here with my ears.
Hold on. Chris is asking for feedback. The executive committee has the right to make this decision. But Chris is asking for feedback. We have the members. We prefer to take feedback to inform. But yes, we have. Yes.
There are two members that aren't on tonight at the moment, as far as I know, who have stated the view that the account should be kept as is. So
Two
BC members who have expressed that view quite forcibly.
On what basis?
Yeah. One of them suggested that it's better image-wise to keep the image that the bank account is located in Europe so that it makes it look like we're reflective of European interest. That's the one that I recall. I don't remember the other one.
You said it could be done in the UK, right?
It could be done in the UK, but then there's the other problem is that in the UK we don't have an address, so we'd have to... I spoke to my own company secretary and said, would you provide an office address service in the UK? And he said, oh, money laundering, you'd have to tell me who the members are. So the only thing we could do is buy one of those €200 a year addresses on Bond Street or something. Our address is, the only address we've got in the world is Marina Del Rey. It was quite difficult to explain to a UK bank that we're sort of on the internet and we haven't really got a base.
Chris and I met with the IPC, and they have followed this approach for the past 7 or 8 years. Chris, is that what they said to us?
Yeah.
And in the U.S.
In the U.S., they're very satisfied with it. The bank account says intellectual property constituency. The signatory is the treasurer. And in their charter, it says that one function of the treasurer, it's an elected position, will be to do this. So what we would need to do is update our charter to assign the treasurer function to the vice chair of finance and operations and say that a suitable mechanism will be maintained to make sure the bank account, blah, 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 always reverts back to the BC in the event that, you know, Chris resigns, et cetera. But I prefer that we have our money. And the second thing that I would just say is we did look into, Mikey will remember this, we did look into moving our bank account to ICANN. We talked to the general counsel. We talked to the CFO. We concluded it was a bad idea to tell ICANN how much money we had. Second week, we concluded it was a bad idea to try to get ICANN to issue our payments. And thirdly, ICANN really preferred not to do that because they're not set up to do it. So it wasn't really feasible to just do that.
So with a new bank account in place and with the treasurer function on that bank account, we're then free to contract an administrative person in lieu of the existing secretariat. And by separating those two functions, it means that whoever's the administrator, and it conceivably could be the person that was administrator last year, because he has said that he would want to tender bid for it.
What did you charge for that?
Well, it's a little bit different at the moment because it's a temporary contract that's gone on for a period of time. So,
Chris, how much did he charge last year when he was the full secretariat for the annual?
26,000, I think.
Euros.
Is that included running some elections?
We held one.
Yes. So we're running at the moment on the slide before at about 16,000 so far this year. So it has been said, oh yes, we're spending less money than we did last year on on the Secretariat facility, which is true. We are spending less money, but we're also getting, at the moment, a lot less work.
So if we were to move it to a bank in the United States, as you, what would the cost of, what would that number be? Instead of 20,000 euros, what would it be?
Well, first of all, we should tell you what the contractor provides right now. The contractor provides for 250 euros a week, the hosting of our bank account, and the hosting of an Excel spreadsheet with all of our contact information. He, for 150 euros of an hour, he does additional work that we ask him to do, such as the invoicing. He's very efficient. I think he was very efficient on doing the invoicing and the collection, and did not require, you know, didn't require supervision. He did require interaction with us and decisions, but he didn't require supervision. On elections, he would also bill 150 euros an hour, but he doesn't have a lot of time flexibility.
And the only retainer element in there was the 1,000 euros a month to do the bank account and the Excel sheet.
Yes.
Sorry. Yes. So, you know, here's what I would propose to do. We need to move on and talk about additional administrative services and support. What I would propose that we do is Chris explore. He meet with the same bank that the IPC uses, Bank of America, just because it's, we know it works there. And tomorrow he's here and explore this and, with the advice of his finance committee representative, move forward with the plan. I also think we ought to have two, and this was something that they said to us as well, we ought to put two signatures on the checking account and do the billing, do the bank account largely by internet banking. Something that you need to know very quickly, it's too much detail, but I just want to go into it. Right now, we paid for a credit card financing function through the contractor. We would probably go to wire transfer payments for membership, and maybe exclusively to that or to check rather than credit card, because I don't really see why we would set up credit card processing. Most people can pay by wire transfer. I think we only had a very few credit cards that were processed.
I would just say, I'm not sure what the small business rate is, like 250 euros, something like that. But a transfer from New York for 250 euros is going to cost us about 40 euros.
Wire transfer is pretty spendy.
Well, can we leave it to them to work out and we'll figure out?
I'll check here in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking for one small business, I'd prefer to continue to accept credit card payments.
Do it through PayPal, too, but we should examine that. And
okay. Well, that's interesting feedback, because I was assuming that most people in the U.S. would prefer to make wire transfers within the U.S.
No. It's $40.
Right.
Thanks.
Really
spendy.
Mine are only $10.
I think we pay for it. I think actually the Secretariat pays for it. We have quite a bit of the fees come.
We both.
Okay. Let's do this. Chris, tomorrow, you know, we'll figure it out. It may be that we take checks instead. We don't have that. We have 49 payments.
Yeah.
But you can do credit cards through
PayPal. And we'll start earlier. And we'll start earlier next year as well.
Yeah, we can do credit cards through PayPal. So the plan is we're going to move, and Chris will work out with the advice of the Finance Committee.
Good. Okay, thank you. Next slide is on communications. On the printed side, we've got the brochure that we did earlier in the year and the newsletter that we've got to roll up our sleeves and get going on this. And again, anybody, I think we're going to have John and I are probably a discussion after this meeting on that newsletter. So if anybody's...
I do have some preliminary thoughts on the newsletter, which is, and many of them will persist.
What your thoughts?
What my thoughts are. Just because I think they are, they dovetail with my earlier comments about creating an environment for a broader and deeper membership. And it has to do with establishing priorities. And so if we have a newsletter, and I think we're leaning towards having it printed only when it coincides with an ICANN meeting. Otherwise, it will only be online, because then it could be marketing as well. That the prioritization is really going to be helpful in focusing the attention of the business constituency on its mission. So, for example, if you recall, Steve threw up the mission for display mission. I had a freaking moment when someone was talking about small members as well. Disoriented. But the idea is that we make the business case in this newsletter, right? So why are these issues important? And so, for example, if we were to take the three areas, new GTLDs, SSR, who is, how would we weight those issues in terms of their importance to the business constituency? And then the newsletter would seek to make the business case. Here's why you should, or here's why you ought to be interested in this, and here's how you can participate, and here's what's going on. So it'd be an opportunity to reinforce the mission of the constituency to help prioritize the issue. Because when you get Steve's policy newsletter email, there's, 12, 15 things on it. Well, they can't all be the same weight. Otherwise, none of us would have the ability to do anything else. And so if we can drive some prioritization and some focus, then maybe we can have not just a more meaningful exchange in the newsletter, but also establish a vehicle for driving a bit more consensus and influence. So ultimately, this all rolls up into influence. Okay? When the BC speaks, which I hope will be more often and more forcefully, then it will be more often heard rather than just deflected.
So let me just... May I just add a footnote to what John just said, and maybe this process back to you, Steve, a little bit, in the sense that if you were to put together this list of all of the, like you've done now, you're doing a fine job, and we appreciate it, and say, let's 1 to 4, 1 being the most important, 4 being the least important, have all the members come back. Maybe you get 25 members come back, maybe you get 10, but at least you got the benefit of others coming back saying these are the highest priorities. It might help prioritize things for the whole group.
So let me
rather than putting money on your back and trying to figure out what the pressure is going to take. But if we could do something like that, it might be very helpful.
If you go and look at the responsibilities page right now, you'll see a mysterious number, 1, 2, 3. About 2 years ago, we did do that, and I think it's worth thinking about again. Let me pass on. Let me pass on a message from Aisha Hassan, and I think this has come from Wado Saganga, one of our WITSA members as well, and that is a newsletter of that nature would be the kind of thing that could be passed on from the association staff to their affiliates and members very easily that shows the benefit of why the association is active in this particular organization. So I just wanted to mention that, John.
No, it's totally in keeping with where I think where I would like to see the conversation continue to go. I mean, I'd like when we have this meeting next year, I'd like there to be 85 people, not just 40.
I'd just like to support you. I think that's right where we need to go. You know, I think that one of the things that the BC needs to be really, really good at is what's in it for members. And the list is pretty long, but it's...
Mike, would you pull up the BC website and project it on the... one thing that we've done, and I want to commend Chris on this, is that we took a very old-fashioned-looking website with totally, totally out of date. Chris worked with Jason to do a rewash of the content and make it look a lot better and a lot more professional. And the other thing that we did is, through working with Del Chapo, we have been the beneficiary of extensive, of extensive photo stories about our participation. And I just handed out as a refresher, but I want it back unless you're going to use it as improvement, the very high-quality membership brochure that we published to use. It's now on the website. But...
you know, one of the things for us to think about is how would this newsletter, John, how, you know, in the future, how could we also use the content of the newsletter to make the story on the front page of our website look more vital and more interesting? Just
well, you know, the newsletter, I realize it's an ancient word to describe what it is we're truly intending. But the idea is to establish a business constituency at the club to which you would want to be a member.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that there are people in it that you want to associate with, that it is active on issues that are important to your business, and that it has influence within the organization. I believe that we could stumble into a bigger organization just because of the role of the Internet. I mean, for someone like Eric Rotenberg to find a Mark Rotenberg, to find a meaning in being inside ICANN, well, you know, that's I would have never thought that he would have done that. But it's clear that there is a growing appreciation for the meta-national policymaking process of ICANN as an important leg, right, in terms of how business is conducted. And the fact of the matter is that companies are confronting these circumstances every day. I mean, any company that operates globally is violating some country's data laws right now just because data doesn't abide by jurisdiction. It goes the path of least resistance, and every country's got different requirements. So if we can make it a visual and pointed document, then it will add to the vitality of the constituency.
So the other thing that I would just say is I think we really need to promote access. Today we had a very large number of ICANN staff and a board member with us. And when we go to the ICANN meeting, we organize effective access for business with the board members and with staff. And I think that's the other thing that we ought to be thinking about is how do we strengthen the message and the understanding that by participating in the business constituency, you are getting effective access. So are we ready to move on, John? Do you need help? Do you need
well,
help?
You know, essentially it's just been me avoiding Chris's calls for the last couple of years. And my intention, you know, with which I have paved my way right to hell, is to have dummied up something that would say, these are the kinds of things that I need that ought to be included in this, and then begin to collect that from everybody.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you, instead of doing a broad thing, I'm going to ask you to solicit input from Lee Williams because of his background in the financial services industry and because he's a new member. And pick, and Susan, I'm going to pick on you. You know, let's pick on Bill, who's a new member, and pick on Aisha, who's volunteered in the past, and maybe pick on one other person, and Laura might be willing to comment, and just get some ideas for mocking up sections like this will be our prototype, right?
It'll be a pilot, yes, but I think we've just got to go for it. I think, you know, it's one of those, isn't it? It's the first step that's
right.
the difficult one, and you look back and you wonder why it was such a difficult first step.
Well, this is Ron. One other small matter. BIZCONS.org. Very difficult to find.
So
why not business constituency?
So we've talked about this. Chris, you want
to? Yes, I don't know the best way to do this. It was sort of a game where we all.
We're going to bid for something.
Not
bid. Yeah, there we go.
And we vote for them. We'll make a list of what's available, isn't it? It's,
So let me do a couple of quick things. We will ask ICANN if we can be business constituency at ICANN.org, which is very possible to do. The other possibility, and Chris mentioned here that we're looking at a meme site, we can buy a couple of other names, probably in .org or .info, and think about this. biz consent doesn't mean anything.
Next slide.
To business people. Business at ICANN also is probably, I don't know that that works. So we do need to think about changing the name. And
it's
Ron
a branding.
Well, now we've got two letters, so maybe EC.biz or something. But there, you know, there's another option.
You can't get two letters at well, that's a country designation.
No, hey, why don't we just bid on dot business constituency? That'll be cheap.
Yeah, it's 185,000.
Pizza
pie. Would you
post the list and say?
Would you
suggestions, please? And
no, it'll drive the members nuts. Would you tell people here in this room and those of you on the call, if you want to propose names to Chris, send him an email off list, please.
So if you want to think about our web address as being part and parcel of expanding and deepening our membership, then wouldn't bc.icann.org be the way to go?
I think we can get there.
I don't know that it's
but it would probably be that we'd have our own domain or domains aliased onto that anyway.
So I have a novel idea. Let's start a Facebook page. Everybody likes it on their own Facebook account, which we all have business, professional friends on Facebook for the most part. At least I do. And then we could also, the Facebook page would be very easy to upload, like, pictures from today's events and, you know, some brief information about what went on today. I think that's easier than to a website, you know, to the our own BC website. And then you could link to the BC website.
So let's walk through the kneeing option and then also talk about Facebook. Would you do that?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Ning, but I mean, Corey even looked at it. I'm quite amazed at what you can do there in this. I mean, it's in a way, it's like Facebook, isn't it? It's Facebook for professionals.
Mark Andreessen would say that. Yes, he would.
Yeah.
we would argue that webmasters
out of business.
Sorry, Susan.
But the greatest recommendation, the next slide, is just the Internet Governance Forum, which Marilyn and Steve. Was working. This is just a screenshot here. And the next slide, please, as well. That was the home page of what you did. And with minimal technical expertise or almost no technical expertise. And
so this is all Ning stuff.
And this is all Ning stuff. And picking up on John's suggestion from recently, how each of the members should have their own page, where doing it through the Ning, and even if it's linked from our existing website, it's going to be a lot easier than writing tickets and getting Jason to do it.
My only concern, of course, is that Facebook is a dues-paying member of business constituents. Ning is not.
Amen.
Besides, it's a lot more.
Poor Zahi would have to leave Pakistan to Facebook.com.
Yeah, that's right.
You can tunnel through my server.
Yes. Anyway, at risking $19.99 a month or something, and we don't even have to sign up for a year. I'm going to get an account and experiment with this and see what we can do.
I've already posted a picture of today's meeting.
Okay, so
yes, you did, Mikey. I saw that.
Yeah. Two action items. If you have a reputable idea for a name that you think business people would like, you need to and would identify with, right? So, you know, Jeff is not going to be embarrassed when Lynn Callie says, "What's this group?" or vice versa. Could you send John and Chris your ideas?
And Robert, you were out of the room when John asked, "Would ICANN allow us to have a third level, bc.icann.org?"
I'm actually asking our communications team that. There's also the option of, dare I say it again, Confluence Wiki as a potential option. So I'll just throw that out.
You're offering me an ICANN platform when I don't have a toolkit yet?
Again, that's part of the menu.
You mean, by that you mean social?
Oh,
You mean the tool called social text?
Social text is being, as you guys were advised earlier during the Brussels meeting very briefly, social text is being phased out. Confluence is the new platform.
Anyone here have experience with Confluence? And if you did bring it up, Robert, would it be something you would provide for us as part of the toolkit at no charge?
It would essentially give you a platform to deal with and manage, just like a lot of working groups and others use
Rob,
today.
You have two people to talk to about this. One of them is Chris Chaplow, and the other one is John. And we're moving on, and they're going
our marketing team.
And they're going to come back and give us an idea.
And I need to be part of that, too, because these policy subgroups will sit there. So
by the time we go to Cartagena, I really want us to have a newsletter online, and I want us to have a mechanism by which people can communicate in a way that they don't have to use the open list. I'll come back to Chris's issue, but so being able to set up a group that members can participate in, and there is a way to manage and keep track of the exchanges, but we are looking ahead at the possibility, are we not, Chris, of we need to decide if we're going to redo our website, rewrite it in Drupal, and try to maintain the website, or we're going to use some alternative. And you're going to look at those options?
Yes, and I'm the way we're heading is to this Ning site to certainly keep us going into next year, because, looking at your IGF site, there's actually no reason why that shouldn't. And then if we want a Drupal site next year, then yes, but it may be that we don't need to go to that expense and we're happy with what we've got.
But we do all agree we want a different name. That biz consist doesn't work.
Const. Really catchy.
Once we've decided on a name, it's easy.
I bet you, though, because of the traffic it's had, when we let it drop, some will grab it.
We're not going to drop it. Moving on.
And from just one last comment and with Rob, from a technical point of view, the ICANN mailing list are the best ones. The major domo of the system is a very good system, that. And presumably there's a way of some of the to have a private version of the list, i.e. you need a password to see the archive page. But from a management point of view, they're better than the other ones that we're working with.
What I'd like to take out as a to-do from this meeting is maybe a follow-up call with you and John and part of the communications and IT teams at ICANN to explore some of this, just be able to identify for you guys options so that then you could pick from perhaps a larger menu of outside sources that you're also looking at.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to go to Marina Del Rey.
Great.
Marina Del Rey Hotel.
Okay.
Thank you. Back to Marilyn.
We have a very important thing to talk about, at least for a while here, and that is we're going to talk about charter updates. Let me explain that when the charter was, there's something on the agenda that I need to cover quickly, but Ken, are you still with us? Okay.
I'm here.
Okay. One thing I need to cover quickly, and I think I should explain the problem and then explain our situation and the proposed solution and then go into a discussion about charter changes. But let me preface this by telling you guys to remind you that the charter was an interim charter. We made a lot of changes, and we made them in something of a rush at the end of the year with a lot of input from different members. And as we've lived with the charter, it's clear that some things are defined and other things are not. What I'm going to speak to now is the issue of opening the elections for counselor and a challenge that we have encountered, and I'm going to explain what the challenge is and what my proposal to the executive committee is to solve it. Okay? So it was my intention to open the election for counselor at the last week, and in preparing to open the election for counselor, I read all of the applicable articles, and that's why I passed out the charter to all of you. And to my surprise, I began to encounter confusion in my own mind on what Article 4.7 means, because I had in my hand the previous charters, the DNSO charter, and the various versions that we went through last year at the end of the year, 15, 16, 17, and 18, and 19. None of those were the versions we voted on. We voted on a different version, which consolidated changes. When I read 4.7, I was surprised to find that we had merged what previously was separate. In the previous draft, 15, 16, 17, as I recall, it said that the vice chair and the chair had to be a member of the BC for a year, but that was not the CSG position did not exist in those earlier versions, was added very late, and the counselors were dealt with in a separate section. In previous versions of the BC Charter, there was no one-year eligibility for election, and in fact, previously, Grant Forsythe, who was not a member of the BC at all, was seconded to be an officer and a counselor. When he left, Alex Wilson, who was not a member of the BC, was seconded to be an officer and a counselor. And subsequently, one of our members, an employee of that member, was seconded to be an officer and a counselor, but had never been affiliated with the BC and had never attended a BC meeting. That's our history. 4.7 says the terms of the office of the chair, vice chair, and CSG representative shall be 1 year. The terms of the GNSO council representative shall be specified in the ICANN bylaws. To be eligible to stand for a position on the executive committee, the candidate must have been a member of the constituency for at least the immediate preceding 12 months. We made a change at the end of the year to add the counselors automatically to the executive committee once they were elected as counselors. This is an important, convoluted explanation.
That's section 4.2.
That's section 4.2.
4.2.
I mean 4.7. Sorry.
4.2 is where
it's part of the
section.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you, Steve. I was going over that. Thank you. The thing I'm referring to is Article 5 on the elections process. What I'm pointing out to you is areas that are somewhat vague. In our election process, and I pointed out to you only so that you understand the timing. Article 7.4 raises another issue, and that is that we do not have any requirement, we have no requirement in the charter that establishes a quorum for purposes of elections. 7.4 addresses quorum only in relation to policy positions, and does not actually address voting on elections. Article 7.7 on other votes is somewhat similar in that it addresses votes of constituency for purposes of development of elections will follow similar procedures to those prescribed for policy development, adjusted on a case-by-case basis according to external criteria such as timeliness. A quorum of 33% of members will be required. The first sentence says for purposes other than policy development or elections. Now, I want to ask you folks only to point out that we missed a few things when we voted the charter, and we're only learning this as we live through it. So this is not a criticism of any of us. Now, the reason these are relevant points is when you look at who can nominate someone, it says a member may nominate any other member. There's no definition in the charter of what is a member, who is a member. So AT&T is a member according to our opening, according to 3, AT&T is a member, and though your association is a member, it doesn't say anywhere in the charter that you have to be an officer of the company or you have to be the designated representative in order to stand. It just says elsewhere member. So here's what I'm proposing to you guys, and we did discuss this at the executive committee. I proposed a flexible interpretation of whether or not that one-year eligibility extends to the counselor election. And my view is that we can interpret it not to extend to the councilor election and let any member in good standing, that means any active person who is affiliated with one of our paid-up members, should be able to be nominated for councilor and stand for election. If the members do not want those people and don't think they're experienced enough but they don't know them, they won't vote them in. And I take that, I made that proposal to the executive committee because I think we need to clarify some of this stuff, and we don't have time to do that before we hold this election. It would have been good if I had noticed all these gaps in the charter before, but this is the first time we've actually held an election under the charter. That's not actually true. We held the officers' election under this charter, and there were no discussions of this, of any of these topics at all. But that election was held like literally the month after we approved the with the charter. I think that, and secondly, Chris and I did hold a call with John Jeffrey, the general counsel of ICANN, to ask him if there was a higher authority, and if there was somebody elsewhere that would trump our responsibility in interpreting this, and I refer you now to Article 14. If disputes arise regarding the interpretation of the charter, the interpretation shall be decided upon by the executive committee without prejudice by any member to file a complaint to the ombudsman. I'm getting to be really good at legal reading. So my proposal is to open the nomination process for 2 weeks, open it tomorrow, and explain the situation and tell the members that the executive committee, four of the executive committee members, support a flexible interpretation of eligibility, and noting that one executive committee member does not support that. And the sixth one has not commented at all. John?
This is John. So what's the interpretation? Because it seems pretty relatively clear the other way. Is there something that where it says that a council member is a member of the executive committee? And then it says, you know, elections for executive committee members, you know, have that 1 year requirement. So what's the argument if you went to the ombudsman person, and because what we don't want is to have an election and they get reversed.
Right.
And then so just what's the best argument that you could craft that it is subject to interpretation?
Counselors are added to the executive committee after they are elected as a counselor. They are not elected to the executive committee and then made a counselor. And the other thing that I would say to you in researching the version that...
So how is that different than an officer?
Do you want me to expand that one,
please,
Marilyn? Because I've gone through all the earlier versions, the version 15 up to 19, the one we voted on. In the earlier versions of the charter, it specifically said the chair and the vice chair should have to be eligible, should have the 12 month rule. And then the council representative, as per the council bylaws. And then when the vet, and that went all the way through, and then CFG was added, and then the very last edition, which was post-Sol, with the council being added, the wording was changed. So that it was changed from to be the term of office to be eligible to stand as chair and vice chair, the candidate of about 12 months. And then it changed to be eligible to stand in the position on the executive committee. So it changed from saying specifically the two posts of chair and vice chair to be able to stand. And that was because the CSG was added. So I'm sure what just happened was, without really giving it much thought, the text was changed.
the intended change was to add CSG rep, but not council. So the drafting error, is that the argument?
Well, I just don't think there's really much thought given to it. But even not looking at the intent, reading it now, as you read it, the way I'm seeing it is, it says to be eligible to stand for a position on the executive committee. Well, the councillor doesn't stand for a position on the executive committee. The councillor stands for a position on council and then becomes the executive committee. So that's my interpretation.
What did John say about that?
John said that he thought he agreed that we need to make every effort to be fair, and we need to lay out our research that we've done, and that it is up to the executive committee, according to the charter, to make the decision. So while the executive committee couldn't make the decision, we have a members' meeting, and I like to review things with the members and hear your point of view. Even if I feel that the executive committee owns the responsibility according to the charter in making the decision. I am just going to say, I told John that I thought we needed to take our history and practice into account as well. And that is why I went back and researched what we had done before. And it's quite remarkable to me that we actually went out and recruited people who had they were not even members. And twice we put people on as officers and counselors who had no relationship with the BC. And we made that decision at the BC, I would say, to the best interest at the time of the
Marilyn, it's Mike. Can I say something in response to that?
Oh, please, Mike. That's why I mentioned we had an executive committee member who did not support this. Please do.
Well, I feel you're really looking back on history is a little bit misplaced, since the reason for those appointments was specifically and really only because we had nobody in the BC that would stand and was eligible due to the geographic diversity requirements at the time. We had 3 council seats at the time. We now only have 2. So I would just say that the history is basically irrelevant.
Mike, let me respond to that, because, as you know, I was the person who recruited one of those people, Grant Forsythe. Actually, we had the option to temporarily waive the geographic diversity requirement if we didn't have someone, and we chose not to do that, but to actively recruit someone. But I think we have a comment or two here. Steve, you had a comment. Mike, Chris, did you have another comment?
This is Steve DelBianco. I was not persuaded by the prior history argument because it may well have been that the drafters of the charter imposed a new eligibility criteria because of past behavior. But instead, I was persuaded to support Chris Chaplow's interpretation, because 2 other places in the same page of the charter, we defer to ICANN bylaws to determine terms of counselors, the election of timing for counselors, and then when you consult the ICANN bylaws on the section for GNSO, there are other elements of how counselors are replaced, considerations on whether they may serve on other groups. So the bylaws were deferred to and referenced at least twice here with respect to the counselors. And it took that into consideration, as well as Chris's point that the counselors are sort of de facto members of executive committee, and they're not elected to executive committee per se. So I don't think the prior behavior arguments are as persuasive as sort of reading the document in the context of the bylaws and the 2 references to the bylaws. Thank you.
Okay, Mikey.
I'm just wondering, sometimes the easy solution is the candidates, if we have any candidates for council, are any of them not members for 12 months?
Candidates have not declared and are instructed not to declare until we open the, basically what we practice is, we open the nomination period, and then people always have the option to disclose. But once we open the nomination period is when candidates start.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is whether this is a problem or not. I mean, if
You're trying to avoid a problem.
Chris, what's the problem we're trying to avoid?
Well, come on, Mike. I mean, isn't it obvious that somebody has an agenda, and that is why this issue is being pushed? Obviously, there's a candidate that somebody knows about, or this issue would not have been raised at the XCOM.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I'm wondering.
One-fourth of our members have joined since January.
Yes.
So that's a fact. And to the agenda issue, I don't consider that an agenda on my part. I consider that being responsible. To note that one-fourth of our members have joined since January, and taking that into account, one-fourth of our members, 11 members have joined. But I think Juan had a comment.
Well, in fact,
but before he goes on, I am going to seriously object to the allegation that as your chair, I have an agenda. I declare my agenda, and I take great... I take it seriously when my members think that I do not disclose my agenda, Mikey and Mike. So if we need to discuss that, let's do that.
I think it would be a good idea to have council candidates that have been with the group longer than 12 months, no matter what.
Well, that's a normative statement, and I think all we're trying to do is to be descriptive in interpreting what is in the charter, as opposed to what should be in the charter, what is in the charter.
But I think when we were writing it, I mean, I kind of remember writing it when we were looking at it. I think our intent was to have continuity, was to have people with history in that role.
Chris, here, when it was written, there was no talk about the council member, because all the... When it was the first edition, the first public edition is edition 15, and it only talks of chair and vice chair with that requirement. The council member being on the XCOM.
Right, but it's these later drafts where a lot of the focus started to come in from the...
Mike, that point doesn't appear in the other drafts either. It appears in the final vote draft. And Ron had a question. Let me call on him and get him into the discussion.
This is Ron Anderf. I'm an old horse in the BC, you know, so 10, 11 years now I'm here. So we've been a usual cast of characters for many, many years. Just in the last 24 months, 36 months, we're seeing a lot, well, I'll even say 18 to 24 months, we're seeing a lot of fresh faces, a lot of serious businesses join, a lot of different players coming to the table. And I, for one, would be thrilled, you know, even if someone had one day experience with the BC, but they're fully committed to the BC charter and fully committed to the to make sure that our voice is brought forward. And I don't want to get into history here, but I have had some wranglings with past counselors where they had felt that they would vote on their own positions, which I found, you know, you're not non-com, you're not voting your position, you are voting the BC position. And so from my point of view is that some fresh blood coming in and looking at the new charter once we finalize it, and then taking that to work from that document could be a very healthy thing for the organization. So for my part, I think that Marilyn going through the history is relevant only to the extent to say this is kind of where we've been all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're getting a new charter in place. Let's get this in cast in stone and make these determinations, which is what we want to do. But I think that fresh blood right now is a very healthy thing. Thank you.
Well, I think you're raising two different issues. I mean, I think, you know, the whole charter clearly needs to get fixed. There's no doubt about that. I'm a little edgy about the driving through a whole feeling that this has, and I'm not quite, you know, fixing the charter is clearly something we got to do, but I think that it would look bad if we went through this arcane discussion about the layers of different versions, blah, 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 and we wound up coincidentally with a candidate that was less than 12 months history. I think that would be a bad idea.
So, Mikey, I'm going to challenge that and say that I would like to trust the members not to vote for a candidate if they don't think they have enough experience. And, you know, So you guys have the proposal I made to the executive committee, and you've heard the feedback. One of the things that we need to do is open the election. We don't have to seat someone until Cartagena, but it's not really fair to our counselor, our incoming counselor, to deprive them of the opportunity to have some parallel period with Mike. Mike's term does not end until the end of the annual meeting in Cartagena. And we are the only constituency who has this strange requirement, by the way, which I probably should have told you guys. And I do not recall that it was intended to apply to the counselors.
I wouldn't call it strange. I mean, it's a requirement we have for our executive
committee. You have to say it's unique in the sense that no one else has that for the rest of it. Yes, Chris.
Yeah, and I just want to say for the record that I have absolutely no agenda at all. I don't know any who's going to be candidates or anything, and you know, for the record. And my opinion actually changed on this when I researched it and started and looked at it. I know it does. I can see where you're coming from.
It's a perception thing. I don't doubt the analysis at all. I think the thing that this conversation and the outcome leads to is a perception issue rather than a legal issue.
And the perception issue,
fair point.
I think it's inside baseball. This conversation feels like there's a young candidate teed up to be put forward. Young in terms of time, and until the beginning of this agenda item, I probably wouldn't have cared. But this feels slimy.
Thank you, Mike, for.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mikey, for that. But I'm going to say that I think that there's another way of interpreting this, and that would have been had I implemented the executive committee's decision without telling all of the members who are on the call. And I think that that would have not been transparent.
Well, that would have led to the same perception, I think.
Well.
It's slimier. I mean, you know, they're slimy and slimier, I guess, but, you know, it does feel good.
And for the record, I have no agenda as well, and I'm not planning to apply for any of the elected positions anytime soon. But at the same time, I look around this room and those that are on the call, and I see, you know, a lot of people that have been here a lot longer than I have. And there's a few of us that are fairly new to ICANN. And in my own personal capacity, I say, you know, I don't think there's going to be a consensus on with this group, the constituency as a whole, to vote somebody into a chair or an elected position that we don't feel comfortable with taking that lead. So in the end, you know, if somebody does come in, X company, and runs for a position, and we don't feel comfortable with them, they aren't going to get elected into the position.
You do know about the voting deal here, where big companies have one.
Yeah, you have
companies don't. And there is a perception that there's a block of votes that's big enough that it can essentially put any candidate it wants up. And I don't think this helps. I think that you gotta step back from this. I mean, I understand that, you know, we had tough time writing this, rugged all along, but the perception of the BC, and this is to the market, is that that we're insiders, we play inside baseball, and we're not transparent. And I think this does not help that perception.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, you know, again, myself also not interested in counselor position or having been involved in the discussion at all.
Particularly not now.
Quietly withdrawn.
But of that, you know, I think the argument, the argument is that this allows someone who has maybe traditionally not been involved in the BC to get more stage, and it actually runs counter to the clubby list.
Okay. I think being a BC, sorry to interrupt, but there are a lot of ways to get involved with the BC, and they are very important to the organization. And I am really uncomfortable with the idea of having counseling, which is a very complicated role, be a newbie. You guys can do whatever you want, but I'm
John.
Yeah, I would recommend that you analyze this in two stages. One is, do you like the 12-month requirement? Because your argument was about the 12-month requirement. Your argument was about the 12-month requirement. And those are all good points, and maybe we should have in the renewal of this charter, or amendment of this charter. But the question is, from the perspective of this election, until that charter is amended, is this charter clear or not? Right? If it's clear, then it should go away. If it's not clear, and it's subject to interpretation, meaning from a U.S. legal perspective, you look at, and you interpreting a contract, you look at only the contract. And then if the court holds that the contract is ambiguous, then you look at what's called parole evidence. You look at the history, you look at the drafting, you look at all the other stuff. So the way I would analyze it as a lawyer is this ambiguous? If it is, take all the other stuff into consideration. If it's not, you got to stick with it and just deal with the consequences until you can change it.
So, Your Honor, is it ambiguous?
I'm going to
take two more comments. Andrew? Hey, Andrew from WITSA. I just want to say a comment from one of the members with the least witted votes. It appears to me that, you know, we are really just, you know, why would we want to limit ourselves? I really like the resonance of the arguments that have been voiced with several people here that, you know, we should trust in our choices. You know, I mean, it's like a democracy. We are the experts, and we shouldn't be limited in electing whatever person we think is most qualified. So I just wanted to let you know that sort of, that sounds like the most reasonable argument to me.
Okay, I'm going to ask if anybody on the phone has a comment before I wrap this up and go to another topic. Andres, thank you. No one on the phone? Anyone else in the room have a comment? I want to go back to the question of whether or not I have an agenda, Mikey and Mike. And can we deal with that, please? And can I ask you what your view is about what agenda that I would have? Because as chair, and I'm happy to let you guys talk about that without me, but I will be very clear. I have no agenda on this.
I clarified my statement in my subsequent statement. I'm not directing this at you, Marilyn. I'm directing it at the perception that this creates.
Okay. Mike?
Correct. Same with me. I didn't say you had an agenda, Marilyn. I said I think somebody does. I don't see why else this issue's come up for such a long discussion, both on the XCOM list and in this members' meeting.
Okay, I just think it's important, since this call is being transcribed and all of our members see it, that we clarify what we're saying, because for members who aren't here and don't hear it, it sounded like two members were making a pretty strong allegation about my, and I wanted to be clear one way or the other so we could clear that up. So it seems to me like we're clear now. The executive committee will talk about this. I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking.
I guess the final comment would be, do we know what other Because I could argue either way that 12 months isn't that long to establish kind of residency before you. You know, the executive committee, on the other hand, I also had the, you know, kind of what Andres was saying of why limit it.
That's the one that is not relevant here.
An interpretation, not of what it should be, but what it is.
No, I'm sorry. I think Jeff asked, do we know what others do? And the answer to that is, this requirement does not exist in the other charters.
Not relevant.
A comment. To paraphrase Bill Clinton, I think this all comes down to the meaning of what standards.
Where are you?
In 4.7, because the counselor does not stand for, you could say, because the counselor doesn't stand for election to the executive committee, it's not applicable. Or you could say, well, because the counselor is automatically added to the standing committee, they are standing. So I think there is ambiguity. I don't have a hard position one way or the other on the one-year requirement, although I think probably personally I come down in favor that someone who's going to vote on behalf of the BC in the GNSO Council should have some familiarity with the BC in 12 months. Isn't a long time to require them to be familiar with the BC. To me, it's not a falling the sort of issue about how it applies to this election, but I think it needs to be clarified, because I think right now it all comes down to what is the meaning of stand. You're not really being standing for election to the executive committee, but you're, because once you're elected as council, you're automatically added. One can say, well, you are in a way standing for election to the executive committee, and I think that needs to be made more black and white than it is now.
Yeah.
Bill, I think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of clarifying the language, but I want to throw one more spanner into the works, and that has to do with the diversification. Yeah, we had a real problem finding a member some years ago for the Middle East, Far East, whatever that was, and so he stepped up to the plate. But I think that he came to his very first meeting, and the next meeting he was our rep. So I just want to make that clear that, yes, standing, what you said about standing is absolutely right, but there's one other element, and that has to do with representation on a global scale. And so that's one of the other elements we need to take into account. If someone joined tomorrow, that could, and Zahi's term comes over, it ends. I don't know, when I look at the members list, how many members we have from his region. I know we have lots in North America, but I don't know about Europe. I don't know about Asia Pacific. And that's another element that we want to keep in our minds. Thanks.
That's a very good point, because Zahi's term does come to an end in 2011. And
our region is going to have tons of people come for that reason. That's the problem.
So, guys, the executive committee needs to take this up again, but we need to spend 15 minutes at least on the charter update process. And I know we've put you through this, but we need to put you through the next 20, 25 minutes on it. I've asked the staff to help us by putting together BC charter outline of sections. I pointed out some of the holes that are in our charter. There are some other challenges in our charter as well, that Chris has identified, and I think Steve is identifying as well. Just in living with the charter, we're finding some things need clarification, other things need either strengthening, et cetera. So can I please, Rob, and the way we did this was we asked the staff to hold the pen, put together an outline, and then Ken and Rob are going to kind of run a discussion to just identify, so we have a mock-up topical outline of where possible additions, edits, or changes could be considered. We're not drafting today. We're just developing maybe a prioritization list, Rob.
We looked at almost the issue spotting. I must say I'm very disappointed. I had a whole 30-minute introduction. Now been blown by the time frame. So. Perhaps I can submit a written copy. Thanks. So, as you know, Seoul was sort of a watershed event, the Seoul meeting, because the new GNSO Council was seated. And in the eyes of a number of folks, particularly on the board, it represented sort of a breaking of the logjam, where all the focus was on the council and how that was structured. And then the hope and expectation was the next period would be much more of a focus on the stakeholder groups and the constituencies. And there were a number of pieces to that. There were two permanent SG charters, I mean the registries and registrars, but just transitional charters for the non-contracted side of the GNSO, the CSG and the NCSG. Then there was this almost serial concept of the reconfirmation of existing constituencies that the board kept putting off until the resolution of some other issues. And so basically all these issues have been in a holding pattern for a period of time. They remained in a holding pattern up through Brussels, really. And so by the end of July, early August,
the staff took it upon ourselves to reach out to the executive teams of the various stakeholder groups and constituencies and say, here's what's coming down the pike. These are areas that you should be paying some attention to. The overall big pictures on that were the stakeholder group charters, and particularly the requirement of the CSG to have a permanent charter in place by Cartagena, and then the reconfirmation of the existing constituencies. Now, what was also going along in that time period, and part of that watershed logjam release, was the work teams that the GNSO Council had established to make recommendations about operations of the GNSO Council, to make recommendations about the operations and best practices of the various constituencies. And in early August, the GNSO Council approved a wide array of recommendations that have a potential impact on your operations as a constituency. And so we packaged all of these together, shared them with, for your guys' purposes, with your executive team. And we did it with the other executive teams within the CSG and said, may want to re-examine your charters. We provided a whole bunch of appendices that outlined what the operating procedural changes were. We even went back to the July 2009 time period when the board approved stakeholder group charters and identified a number of potential areas they might look at in the future for transparency and accountability. So in preparing for this meeting, and a quick other step back, we offered our support for the various groups and said, we're happy to answer questions, we're happy to partner with you, we're happy to just sit and let you guys do it on your own. What Marilyn and Chris asked us to do coming into this meeting was just to do some issue spotting. We took our standard staff template, it doesn't exactly match, you know, yours, and create a series of slides just to essentially issue spot for you areas of your charter that you may want to look at, either because there's a new procedure that you might want to take advantage of. The GNSO Council has a number of new abstention and proxy procedures you might want to look at. There are aspects of the broader context of the relationship between constituencies and stakeholders that you must consider. There are best practices. We've seen charters from other constituencies that you might want to look at. And so we just said, you know, we'll provide that to you guys. And, you know, Marilyn and Chris told us, we'll make decisions. You guys give us possibilities. So what we did, and I don't know if Ken, you're still on the line, because you had the link off about 5:15. Well, that's just a set of slides that identify a number of particular areas. And let me go quick to get them over. This I just basically talked to. Why now? We've got the board charter elements from back in 2009, the work team recommendations, and just general best practices that we developed from our various templates and research looking at other constituency charters. And so we identified 11 major areas. Again, as I said, these don't track precisely to your chart, but provide areas of potential interest.
To your point, slide, you could add, because some ambiguities have been identified that are important to resolve.
Yeah, well, there's this whole concept of, and we threw around this word, permanent charters. I mean, these are living documents. You guys last produced your version, or your current version, last November, and some of that was in a response to staff feedback on changes that have been taking place. There will undoubtedly be changes taking place another year from now. It's kind of neat to see you guys sort of discussing, you know, these possible changes, and that will likely happen years from now as well. But this slide just shows the major areas. What we've done in terms of trying to highlight things is just flag with red text, and we'll share this. You guys can take the slide with you. You know, as the 11th section of the mission and principles, those are pretty standard. You guys seem to have that pretty strongly together. As you look at constituency leadership, particularly the executive committee, there are areas in terms of the composition with respect to officers and additional members of the executive committee that you've already been talking about. There are there that you may want to look at a little bit more closely, and I think you've already identified that as an area to look at. One thing that we noticed that was that you don't deal with vacancies and how to handle that, what happens if some somebody departs or things like that. That might be something you want to look at as well.
You have an additional member with CR next to it. What is CR?
Those are council reps.
Thank you.
And the broader issue there is the relationship between the constituency and the stakeholder group. At the very beginning of the day, there was a group of the various constituencies talking about that charter. Stakeholder group exists to apportion those council reps, and it occurred to me when Ron was talking about diversity, that may be something that floats up to the stakeholder group level as opposed to having to wrestle with too much of the diversity at your at your level.
So today what it says is no more than three of the counselors of the six can be from any single geographic region. That's all it says. It doesn't say that of those three, they have to be spread across other regions. We can come back to that, but it does say no more than. So that requires some amount of geographic diversity at the constituency level because our two can't be from the same region.
Right, and that requires some liaison work with you because you pick two people from Asia from the IPC, and you immediately begin to see a problem. So if there's some way through the nomination process or whatever to make the broader stakeholder group aware of who potential candidates are, that might drive some of your elections as well. I'm not sure you'll come up with a solution to that.
Could you just go back to under 2.1, can you and Ken also tell us, not now, but can you tell us what other constituencies do? Because I've read everybody's charter, but not everybody here has read everybody's. In the future, we might like to know does all of the constituencies have an executive committee? Are the councilors automatically on the executive committee in all of the constituencies? Just that kind of fact-based information.
Ken, with your remaining minutes, can you touch on that real quick?
Yeah, sure. In fact, what I can say is that the way that the staff new constituency template came into being, which was really one of the items that we used to put this whole outline together, was in fact looking at all the charters and pulling elements from all of them and putting that into what we thought would be a really good new constituency template. And so to some extent that's already been done. It's reflected exactly in what you see in this outline, Marilyn.
Okay.
And what's driving us, too, that you need to be appreciative of is, there is this concept that keeps floating around more primarily in the non-commercial arena than the commercial, the concept of new constituencies. Mm-hmm. And members of the board, particularly the Structural Improvements Committee, have been working on and really holding our feet to the fire with respect to what are the criteria. You can't be expecting new parties to have additional obligations from existing constituencies and vice versa. And so that's what sort of drove this concept of a template. Again, as we've told new proponents as well as existing folks, you don't have to use it. And as you know, these don't track exactly with your current sections and things like that.
I can say this, though, this is Ken again, that all of the proponents, the new constituencies so far, that have put charters together have followed the template very, very closely. So that it seems to have met the needs of some of the newer constituencies as they look at these charter issues.
Yeah, I mean, our major interest is just helping the board when it conducts its evaluation. Does it see similar things? We don't know what their ultimate decisions will be, but we want to give them a structure and a sense. They've given us advice based on some of their decisions last summer, and so we're just trying to create a structure that makes it easier ultimately for everybody. The next slide talks more just about executive committee duties, in particular where we notice that there is not as much specificity in your guys' charter as in others is the conducting of the elections. You guys have talked about that. The management funding and expenditures, you talked about that earlier when Chris was talking about the management of the savings account or whatever. Yeah.
Are you suggesting that in other charters you've seen them be explicit about bank account management?
No, but about just more specifically what the duties of the treasurer are, how they, I think that's right, Ken, in terms of, but I don't think it goes to the level of the specificity of a bank account, correct?
No, that's correct, Rob. It doesn't.
And the other two items that we've identified here in terms of the executive committee is how do you resolve disputes? A polite exchange today in this meeting about, you know, how to do that, and you don't really have a formal structure for doing that. And then, although you do have a piece in the charter about outreach, it's fairly slim, and again, that might be something that you want the executive committee to focus on. Major area that you probably still have to do a little bit of work on is just the concept of your council reps, and again, this is comparing with other charters, and just again, more of an issue of specificity more than anything else. What are the duties and obligations? Other groups, you know, have certain attendance expectations. Some of it is fairly broad, some of it more specific.
You're on 3.1. Sorry, Brian.
So yeah, just in general, that concept. Ken, is there anything that we should highlight in this area? I'm talking a little bit over myself because I'm conscious of the time. I don't want to shortchange anything, but I also want to try to spot all the areas.
Yeah, that's it. I think these topics are, especially 3.3, I think is probably the one that we'll find a lot more said in other organizations. I remember, for example, when we were in Seoul, the ISPC group realized that they didn't have anything in their charter that obligated their council reps to vote constituency positions. And so they quickly put some paragraphs together, and in their latest version, they did exactly that. And so that's the kind of thing that's what we're pointing out here as potential areas to consider.
Yeah, we're not suggesting a certain point of view, because by the same token, the NCSG says we don't expect you to vote. We expect you to vote your conscience, and so you are not tied. So it really depends upon what you all agree to, but the point is that there is some specificity in terms of spelling it out. That provides, again, your membership and you all with a little bit more certainty and clarity in terms of operations.
And I'm sorry, on 3.2, what you mean there is geographical representation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that's off the geographic region as opposed to...
Yeah.
Did you see stakeholder charters where even the executive committee officers had to adhere to a regional distribution?
I don't believe so. Ken, do you recall anything like that?
No, I don't, Rob.
Yeah, okay.
It's another example where councils are treated differently than executive committees.
Because of the GNSO council obligation writ large in the bylaws, as opposed to your obligations as individual communities, it's all this constant back and forth between the board saying we don't want top-down management dictating what you're doing, but at the same time, we do want to create a structure for it. 4.0, just in general, the committee's just responsibilities for chairs. I mean, this assumes, I guess, that you'll have some committees. Maybe you won't, but do you want to identify how chairs should conduct themselves, certain processes, procedures? Those would be areas that you might want to consider expanding on a bit. In terms of general membership, which you all do a really good job right at the beginning of saying, okay, here's our mission, here's our purpose, boom, membership. You do have a provision about applications for membership. It doesn't specify a type of application. I don't know, as you get larger, you get more diverse, or you look at, you know, all these folks who are coming in the door, whether you want to have a specific format, a specific approach.
Let me ask. We have a standard application format. We have fees, et cetera. Is the point that not all of that is in our charter? Because we have membership requirements. That is in the charter. We have a membership application that's not in the charter. We have membership fees
that
are not in the charter. It is in the charter. So what did you mean by that?
I think, again, it's a measure of, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ken, of that level of detail. You know, there's that challenge between a charter and operating rules and procedures.
Right.
Do you have everything in one document, or in this case of, if I'm correct, some stakeholder groups and constituencies have a very bare-bones charter and then reserve the rest for know, separate operating procedures. You all have seemed to go in the direction of putting more detail in your charter.
I see.
And so we're inclined to say, well, there's detail missing. If it's not here, you don't seem to have another document.
Yes, but the other groups do that. Is the policy of procedures outside of the charter, is it approved more easily than amendments to their charter? Is that why they have it?
Yes.
Typically, that's my experience, too. It turns out in our charter, it only takes a majority vote of the members and not a lot of advance notice, in fact, none, and only a support of 25% of members before being put to a vote. So ideally, this charter document is relatively easy to amend. Do the other groups have harder rules to amend their charters?
That I can't.
Yeah.
At least one. Yeah, and again, that becomes a philosophy in terms of your approach. As long as you're...
One document feels simpler than two if it's easy to amend the document.
Ken, I think member rights was just simply our discussion on this. It was a reflection that could be fleshed out a little bit more in this document.
Yeah, and in particular, Rob, that one came from the a strong statement that came out of the CSG work team and the fact that constituency member should have rights and it should be in the charter. So that's why that's in there.
Those came out of the 5 August decision from the GNSO Council approving those recommendations.
So if I could just, so member rights is members should have the right to be heard, members shall have the right to
vote in elections and to participate in working group, that kind of thing.
Okay, got it.
Item 6, or Section 6, elections, votings, and decisions, again, just a couple of items there with respect to the announcement of the results of elections. You've already discussed some of your eligibility issues there that we had also flagged. In terms of decision-making, a number of other groups use consensus as their approach as opposed to straight voting. I don't know if you have an interest in sort of in declaring a particular standard of decision-making, but that seems to be more the trend.
We do declare the voting in here, right?
Right.
Okay.
So that's again, we're just issue spotting, not suggesting one course of action or another. You do, as we move to Section 7, you do flag the fact that you will have a constituency website and some form of communication. The issue there, I think, that you need to scope a little bit more is what sort of membership information do you collect and make available, folks, and do you use the website for that?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay. Yes. You mean it's not in the charter, but
right.
We do.
Correct.
I see. Okay.
Again,
right.
This is all just
okay.
Driven what's in black and white in the
I
document
see.
Itself,
right. Okay.
And whether you want to show that. When it comes up for reconfirmations, and by the way, the board's moving toward truing up the constituency reconfirmations with the GNSO, with future GNSO reviews, so you don't have this goofy thing like we had now where they aren't in sync. So when that time comes, again, part of our advice on this is the more you can package things together, the more that's clear, the easier it will be for you to do your quote-unquote self-audit. Yes, we should be reconfirmed because we do the following. Look at our charter. We have, we're very transparent. We have member information available here or there, or this is how we manage it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, an overall sense of an area you want to get more detail. Publication policies, and Ken, you can give me a little bit more detail here. I know that you guys have, in particular, spent a good period of a good part of your charter talking about participation and expectations and behavior. I don't recall. I'm blanking, Ken, on the quote-unquote appropriate content item there. Can you flesh that out briefly?
It's Ken's not. It's Ken. Our charter used to say a lot more about you couldn't post more than 3 times a week, and you couldn't post more than 4 times a month, or something. And if you posted duplicate posts, you could get kicked out of the membership. Quite detailed. It also had a reference to appropriate content. Had to be consistent with the purpose. I think it still says, Mikey, it has to be consistent with the purpose of the BC or something like that.
And it also addresses inappropriate content in the sense that a member can bring a complaint and the executive committee can suspend a member for inappropriate complaint or something.
There was a big solidarity section. You still have that?
No.
It does say that if you speak on behalf of the membership, if you speak, Marilyn Kay speaking for the BC has to adhere to the BC position, versus Marilyn Cade, I am a BC member, but I am speaking only as an individual.
No, the solidarity thing was that you could be moved if you disagreed, or, you know.
We struck that.
Yeah, that's the part we took out. Yeah, it was like, what? A lot of chatter on the list of free speech. You're all at the barricades on that one. It's great. Sorry.
And then limits on communication.
Well, as we identified in the material that we sent to you, some of the issues that the council has approved in terms of the recommendations of the work team included the group mailing list open to the entire group, publishing the outcome of all group policy decisions, a privacy policy for the group. I think you touch in all these areas, but it's just a matter of perhaps looking at some of this stuff, Marilyn and Chris, in terms of trying to evaluate whether you want to go a little bit farther with that.
Yeah, we need to go and look. We had a privacy policy statement on our website as well.
Right.
But we'll go look. Thank you.
Yeah. We have some privacy hawks in our constituency. I'm sure that's there.
You do have a section as well on meetings here. We asked you to look at that in terms of considering whether you want to be more specific in terms of specific membership meeting formats and how you handle things for people who are absent. Again, there are issues here connected potentially with transparency and openness in terms of translation, remote participation, things which I'm observing you do as a matter of course, and that, you know, will be supported in the future. The question is how much detail do you want to get into your charter? A section on committee meetings would perhaps be helpful, too. I think Ken's feedback on that is that you may want to highlight that section as opposed to have that buried with some of the other meeting requirements.
So hold on. Let me just – so here the reference to committee is related to we said we might have working groups. The committee we had is finance committee, but so what are the duties of any committee in terms of transparency, et cetera? That's the point.
Yeah, the recommendations from the work team came out saying groups should adopt and publish a standard set of rules and procedures to govern group committee constitution and operations. The establishment and formation of all committees should be made known to the entire group membership, and eligibility to participate should be open to all members. These are things that you have been addressing today that aren't parts of your charter. But we're also just trying to flag things that are not requirements that
we have
two.
We have a credentials committee and a finance committee. They are limited in their number, but any member can be considered.
Right.
Versus if we had a working group and what the criteria is for them. I don't know, Steve, you're going to want to look where.
Right. It's called a committee or task force right now.
Yeah.
Which we call an internal working group.
Yeah.
It would be a committee. We need to take a look at those rules.
So you might have 8.3, task force, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. Can you take a look at that?
Yeah, I don't think the recommendations, you know, were tied up in terms of what you labeled or what you called things. They used committee in a general form. There's also an issue, and Ken's more of an expert on this. I think the heat was on the work team with these recommendations, but there was a lot of debate within the work team about the term should versus must. And as I understand it, should in this context is it would be a really good thing to do, yes. And so that includes things like publishing membership lists of all active and inactive committees and their minutes, action points, decisions, resolutions, and final work products within a reasonable period of time. So just, again, best practices, things that you may want to consider, some things you may already do as a matter of tradition. The issue again becomes 3 years from now when it's time for another reconfirmation of the committee and you were all off doing something else, will the members of this group looking at the bylaws or the charter, will the new board members be able to evaluate it in a consistent way? And that's what we're trying to learn.
So here's something, a big thing that's missing that I see, Ken. We have a process in our existing charter which describes how we make policy. And I don't even see a place to put that here. And that would be maybe.
Well, no, that would probably be in that. You know, we can, Ryan, give you some suggested formatting issues. Obviously, we've got our own template that we can share. I don't know that you want to completely revamp your own charter, though. I don't know that that makes a lot of sense.
No, I'm just pointing out, you know, for Steve and for others, like, you know, 4.0 could be committees,
mm-hmm.
but the policy development process that exists in our present charter, although it may need to be improved, still needs to be reflected in. Because it's both thresholds, et cetera.
And I would ask you to whether stakeholder groups lay out the process of policy drafting and approval the way we do.
No. You are, from what I've seen, the most detailed in that regard.
So they run it ad hoc?
No.
It's just a much simpler approach in terms of reaching decision making. Again, it's that philosophy, I think, between a super detailed document, a more general document, and some of that reflects the culture of that community, I think.
So the registries and registrars both do, don't they, John? Do you remember? I think they both have some description of how they approve.
Absolutely.
And they require votes and documenting the votes. So.
Well, in some cases, yeah, in terms of the reporting and voted in the election and things like that. You know, here, all the organization says is a standard set of rules and procedures to govern group committee constitution and operation. You've satisfied that from that perspective. The question is, do you like it? Is it too detailed? Is it not detailed enough?
That obviously would cover it. I mean, the way our committees operate doesn't address the notion of the committee of a whole when it's voting on an official position. It's a different
animal. Yeah.
So I think we just need a section that describes the policy development and approval process someplace appropriate.
Section 9 talks in a little bit more broad sense, and that's really sort of a placeholder, to be honest, because right now the work team that's been developing the outreach recommendations hasn't completed its work. You guys do have a section on outreach. In just occasional bar conversations with some of you, I think I picked up what we even have internally within ICANN staff, a case where people define outreach in different ways. You know, what does outreach mean? Is it recruitment? Is it just publicizing? Is it marketing? Is it PR? What does outreach mean? So that's something that we flagged would be an area that you may want to take a look at.
Can you read ours by design?
I think it's very broad. If that's right, if that's what you mean, but what does it say? It says...
Number 12.
Right. The BC will, in tandem with other members of the CSG, make best efforts to broaden the participation of business users whenever possible.
According to available resources. Take money.
And what's broad participation? Is that membership recruitment? You had a broad discussion today about, you know, here are new members, here are members we're losing. I honestly at this moment can't remember if you do have a question here about recruits or whatever, or do you have
a point? Broad participation to what we mean.
Well, I think we'll take up a discussion of whether all participation has to result in recruitment, but, right, because, you know, I would just say Chris represents an association, so does Anders. I think we really welcomed, so does Aetna and others, really welcome participation of their members.
But my interpretation is that members of those associations are not automatically members of the constituency. It's the association that's a member.
And they wouldn't ever take a position voting on anything or right. Substantive participation, be to sit in, to listen, and perhaps hopefully be then recruited directly by the BC.
Right. I mean, there could be a future where all your members are also BC members. I don't know if that's your business model or BC's business model or even if that makes any sense. They probably already decided that you guys, we want you to do that so that we don't have to. I don't know. But again, that's an area that others have looked at that you may want to consider looking at.
finances. You don't even have to charge fees. But again, folks who, you know, set this up talked about essentially what the fees are, the mechanism for setting them, funding sources. I don't know why, I'll be honest, what we have the invoicing and delinquency, but those are issues that others may deal with. You don't pay, what does that mean? Are you still a member? Can you vote?
That's in there.
Yeah. Conflict of interest, and transparency. You all seem to do that. I don't know if it's, if you want to spell that out more, you know, the finance team will, you know, on a monthly basis provide a financial report to folks. That's an area we can work at as well. In terms of amendments, we have flagged that in a particular red area. One thing that we really like, though, is the version control that we developed. It's just a standard format. Sarah used it for the CSG charter, just reflecting, particularly when it sounds like you guys were discussing the number of versions last time, that you know what version this is, and having that attached to the document very clearly can be very helpful, particularly when you're going through the drafting process. That can be a very easy form of management control. Yes, sir.
You're done with substantive areas. I had one question that jumped out at me, but I was wondering if, in your review of other charters, do any of the cities have a charter requirement to have a professional person providing certain services?
Not that I can recall. There are provisions for secretariat.
Right. So what we have in 4.9 is for a secretary, but we lay out specifically, you know, certain duties, and constructive, and then constituencies have that essentially requirement that we use. If, for example, we had a volunteer and a member who could run the website, for example, mm-hmm. that would be a violation of our charter. I thought that was
a number of them that we've seen do, and I've lost Ken, so I can't speak to one specifically. They identify that there will be a secretariat. They may generally describe the duties. I don't recall any of them this level of specificity.
This is actually, we changed the heading from professional secretariat to be secretariat services, and it was supposed to be, there shall be secretariat services available. But, you know, we were going through some of the edits, and we just didn't get everything changed. It's the functions, I think we ended up saying, everybody agrees these are the functions that are needed. But it is pretty detailed, isn't it?
Might be a place where we even say should instead of shall. Like, I'm not sure who does it.
Well, that part of the charter is left over from the old charter,
yeah.
which was real secretariat-driven and basically a job description.
Well, in this, you know, in the level of detail that we went through this is because we wanted to be fairly exhaustive. We do have written stuff to back this up. I don't know if you ever want to see that.
Whatever you have.
We can do that.
It doesn't work. See it.
Okay.
And you also have that analysis you did on a charter that you then updated.
Yes. I mean, we're happy to, you know, share that with you guys, share the broader group on your mailing list. I think what it speaks out to, and this is sort of the challenge that Mikey raised earlier when he was asking some of his uncomfortable, just very general questions, and that is, what does the constituency look like in this new ICANN 3.0 or whatever, GNSO 2.0? Where you have the potential for group participation. You know, what is the real hook and interest? Why does somebody want to become a constituency?
Yeah.
Go through some of these challenging processes. And I think there is value proposition, but it's incumbent upon you guys to sort of work through that. And there is a real balance, and we're very conscious of this. You currently have single space each charter. If you look at some of these things, it could be a double-spaced 20-page charter. If you really wanted to go full hog in the level of detail, you have a better sense of your culture and community as to what that right balance is. That's not for us to determine. All we can do is say, well, if you really did it all, you could have 30 pages single-spaced. Okay, understand that, because I've had a number of discussions with Philip Shepherd about CSU. No, sort of what would be the right balance?
And that's, again, up to you guys. We're just giving you the raw material. Just very quickly, and I know that I've gone longer than the couple minutes that you gave me, Marilyn. And that is possible next steps in timeline. I had this conversation with Steve Metallic this morning. We are currently trying to operate and give you guidance based on current board deadlines and timetables. Right now, the expectation of the board after several extensions was that there would be not only a permanent CSG charter by Cartagena, but they were hoping to have new charters or updated charters from the various constituencies by the Cartagena meeting. Part of your feedback to us could be, yeah, we're right on schedule, or no, we need more time. That's certainly been the case with some of the other groups. The board has, I wouldn't even begin to speculate as to the board's reaction, but the Structural Improvements Committee, which has jurisdiction for these types of matters, is still looking at a fairly broad space. So if you're interested in pushing off some of these deadlines or managing that process, you would certainly want to begin talking about that. I would balance that with a timetable that says, oh, we need more time, here's our timetable, and this is what we think we can accomplish. Because I think the board is also sensitive, as they have been with prior extensions, that these groups don't exist just to create rules for themselves. They exist to provide policy advice, substantive work, and there's a balancing mechanism that has to take place there. If you wanted to go through word by word your document, it might take a longer period of time. If you just wanted to make some very strategic changes based on some of your elections that are coming up, all I would ask is that you do, as you do amendments or you do changes, that if you could always share the latest versions with us, then we're in a position to communicate with board members who ask, where are they on this? And why, you know, it's 3 years later, why isn't this done? We have good explanations for that, but they can be supported by, you know, other feedback that you all provide. But this is the timetable right now. I would suggest that even if some of these documents got in, it would be very challenging for the board to make any decisions at Cartagena.
Yeah, so maybe they ought to be asking us for a delay.
Well, part of the issue that we see from a staff perspective, what we're recommending is that anything that comes up go to public notice. And, you know, a public comment period would not be inappropriate, and particularly when you're talking about reconfirmations. And
public comment period on our charter?
Yeah.
And this is, so if I understand this, the public. So we're going to update our charter. Okay, let's just follow this. We're going to update our charter. It's going to be consistent with the improvements criteria and consistent with what our members believe fairly represents their interest. The members are going to vote.
Chair, with Richard, Ellie's
on. The members are going to vote on it, and then we're going to give it to staff. Staff's going to say, yes, it looks pretty balanced to us, or we gave them this suggestion, and instead they did this. But here's, let me just follow this. Here's our recommendation to the board that's still going to go to public comment, which basically says that hypothetically the ALAC or other parties could say, oh, my God, they've established an individual recruitment subgroup, and that competes with us. So I'm just trying to make something up. And the purpose of public comment is to see if we're fair.
To the extent that in this limited sense, this is a process for reconfirming existing constituencies. This isn't, I mean, this isn't the board just coming and saying, every time you change your charter, we should put it out for public comment. No, this is a unique phase in the board's GNSO improvements review process.
Okay, then here's my, that's what I understood. So here's my question. The charter actually is not the whole story, it seems
to me.
The whole story is these people actively work to reach business. They do these things when they're in Kenya. They help business outreach. It's the rest of the story. The group recognizes that it today is limited in its geographic business presence, but is doing these things.
I think you can look at it as an opportunity.
That's not going to be in the charter.
No, I think that is, you know, dear Peter, consistent with the board's requirement, we have a meeting. Here we are submitting prior to the Cartagena meeting. We should be reconfirmed because, oh, here's a copy of our charter. By the way, we've worked with the community and the staff to do our best to make it consistent with the board bylaw principles.
So an analysis of our membership, how we do represent small businesses and associations, the fact that we've grown 25%, those are the kinds of additional facts that would go into a cover document.
And I would look at that as an opportunity. I mean,
yes.
That's an outreach document.
Right.
Because,
right.
You know, there are either constituencies or groups or those within the GNSO community who over time have said, well, they don't do what we do. We don't do what they do. And so it's an opportunity to do that.
Is the charter approval on that slide a separate timeline than the reconfirmation?
No.
They're the same, treating them as the same thing.
That's how we're.
So the notion of asking for a delay, the board has too much to do. That would be a delay in both the charter and the recon.
If I were doing this, one thing I would consider would be, because I honestly don't know, we've been trying to make various suggestions and recommendations. You may not have formal feedback by November 15th that says we have extended. What one could foresee doing is to say, you know, consistent with your resolution, we are hereby requesting reconfirmation. Here's our latest, you know, all the great reasons why you're consistent. Here's kind of our latest chart. We are continuing to work with staff and within our own community to update it to reflect the latest GNSO operating procedures and the rest. We will update this submission at the time when we've done that. That would be one approach.
Well, let me just ask the folks here in the room and on the phone. I think our experience is our members have limited appetite for administrative stuff, and more they prefer that we spend our time as much as possible on policy positions, and we have an aggressive agenda. If we put them through a charter approval process every 6 months, I think that's the death. That would be my
agree.
Yeah.
Well, I think this has just been, it's possible, this has been a unique circumstance in ICANN where, you know, because of larger structural issues, the stakeholder groups and their connections with constituencies, these pieces have been punted down the road again and again while the stakeholder group charters are being resolved. And we're still at this moment, don't have permanent charters for all four stakeholder groups. At the same time, the board has a resolution from last year saying, well, after a year, we'll review the stakeholder group structure. So there are a lot of moving parts to this. I don't think board members want to have this perpetual situation. And to be honest, I only came up with this advice to you when you asked the question. Oh, wow. Is there a way to, where the board, I could foresee coming back and saying, thank you very much, that's great. We reconfirm you subject to you making the modifications to your charters that you represented. If you do that, you're fine, and we'll talk to you again in 2015.
Okay. Any final questions on the phone? Anyone have questions for Rob? This is a phenomenal piece of work and very, very helpful to us. And I particularly want to thank you and Ken because both Ken and Rob went through our charter, sat down with some of the members, with Chris and me and Sarah, and tried to compare between the CSG charter needs and ours. And it's very helpful to have your work and the fact that you know what's going on in the other charters, Rob, and can help also to do some interpretation on the improvements. So the good news is we're going to continue to ask for your help.
Well, thank you. What we'll do is go back and polish up sort of this rough work that we've done today. It's only reflecting these slides and just share with you, you know, what we've got.
As you polished it, I'll request, you had one color red.
Mm-hmm.
If there are things you think are red letter for us that we must do, indicate it. If there's things we might want to consider, use that phrase many times today, put yellow on it.
Okay.
If you put, so we know things are a priority versus maybe.
Well, yeah, because the one thing I didn't touch on is that there are, with some of the new GNSO operating procedures, and the absentee provisions. That you have the option to adopt.
Right, that you have the option to adopt, that you don't have to. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, you're right.
So I'm just going to do one final topic as Jeff is leaving. I just want to remind people we are going to Cartagena. Some of us are going to Cartagena, and if you don't know where Colombia is, I have a world map. I have a map for you. I've asked people to share with me what hotels they are staying at. We have people staying at Hotel Cartagena de Indias. I think a couple of folks are at the Hilton. I've asked the marketing manager for .co, who's familiar with all of the hotels, to come back and give me some information on how far they are geographically. So they are going to do that. The other thing is I need to know from you by email as soon as you can to me off list if you are coming to Cartagena, because Chris has added a number of people to the meetings list, but in addition to that, we're going to need to start planning whatever outreach events and social events we do. Let me also announce that WISA has a member in Colombia, and ICC has an association affiliate in Colombia, and Aisha and Anders and I are having a planning call about doing outreach to them, and the marketing manager for .co has agreed to invite the Colombian businesses to come to ICANN with a specific target from us by saying, you know, we're one of the sponsors of ICANN. We encourage you as business to come to the ICANN meeting. So that may give an opportunity for us to build on some further business interaction while we're there. This has been a busy day. Any last comments from anyone before we wrap up and talk about whether there's a bar in this town we can find?
Down here in Maryland? I think that Barry spoke about something very interesting earlier in the day, and it moved by pretty quickly, but he made the comment about perhaps we have a BC meeting once a month. It doesn't have to be face-to-face, certainly a call, but I would commend you on having pulled this together in spite of some of our members not agreeing. I think it's been very helpful. We went through a lot of stuff today and covered a lot of very important ground, and I think if we could break this down into 12-month bite-sized portions over the course of a year, along with our face-to-face meetings at the public meetings, I think that would be very helpful. So I think Barry hit the nail on the head, and I just wanted to recommend that as well.
And that was supported by, I think, Susan and by John and a couple of other people, Mikey. So the executive committee is going to have a 10-minute meeting. How many of you are local and want to find a nearby bar that serves beer or something stronger? One? Okay. So, Rob, can you join?
Unfortunately, no. I have a conference call in a couple minutes. I just want to clarify, do you want the recording to stop? Thank you very much.
Thank you for stopping the recording. I could see I would never again be elected as anything if I planned a social event that didn't take the rest of the members into account.
Thank you, operator. You can stop the recording.
Bob.